This is Audible.
DH Audio presents Promise Texas by Debbie Maycomer. Read for you by Eliza Foss. Annie, I'm so sorry. I can't tell you how sorry I am. Annie Applegate shifted the receiver to her other ear and blinked repeatedly. Jane Patterson's sympathetic voice had brought tears to her eyes. It had taken Annie nearly 12 months to write her childhood friend about the disasters that had befallen her in the past 2 years. Jane had called the minute she'd read the letter. Annie was grateful for that, although even now, a friend's genuine sympathy threatened her shaky resolve in a way that indifference didn't. "You should have let me know," Jane continued. "I couldn't," Annie said. "Not right away." Jane had moved to Promise, a town in the Texas Hill Country, 3 years ago. She'd gone there to work in the local health clinic as partial payment for her medical school loans. Her parents had been dismayed and delighted in equal parts when their only daughter married a local rancher and settled down in the small community. "What are you going to do?" Jane asked briskly. "Do you think you'll stay in California?" Annie wished she knew. The question was one she'd asked herself 1,000 times since the car accident and everything that had followed. I don't know. Probably not." Only Annie had nowhere else to go, nowhere she needed to be, and no real family to speak of. "Come to Promise," Jane said, her voice unnaturally high with excitement. "Texas? You want me to go to Texas?
Oh, Annie, you'd love it. This town isn't like any place else in the world. The people are friendly and kind, and there's a sense of caring here. Promise is small-town America at its best. Small-town Texas at its best, too." Annie smiled. "I'm sure a visit would do me a lot of good." "I'm not suggesting a visit. I think you should move here. You need a change, a fresh start. It might sound odd, but I have this feeling that Promise needs you, too." Staring out the display window, Dovey Hennessy watched her husband hurrying toward her shop. Judging by the look on his face, he had something he couldn't wait to tell her. Frank Hennessy barreled into the store a moment later, his eyes twinkling with amusement. At 65, he remained muscular and fit, Dovey noted with pride. Every time she saw him, he gave her heart a little thrill, even after 4 years of marriage. After the death of her first husband, Duffy had expected never to love again. Frank had been an unexpected surprise, a precious treasure that Duffy would never fail to appreciate.
"My goodness, Frank, what's gotten into you?"
"Deputy Jordan," Frank told her, shaking his head. "I swear, I've never seen anything so funny in my life. Just wait till you hear what that fella did this time around."
"Sheriff Jordan," Duffy gently reminded him. Frank had retired 5 months earlier, and it had been an adjustment for both of them. After serving as the town's sheriff for almost 15 years, Frank had found it difficult to hand over the reins to someone else, especially when that someone had been such an unpromising specimen during Frank's early years as sheriff. As a teenager, Adam Jordan had gotten into one scrape after another, and had nearly worried his parents sick before he enlisted with Uncle Sam. Somehow, the army had straightened him out, and he'd returned home to become the town's new sheriff.
"Boy's made a fool of himself with that new teacher," Frank chuckled. "Again. Locked her keys inside her car trying to show her the importance of security."
Dovey groaned, embarrassed for Adam. Anyone could see he was infatuated with Jeannie French. Fresh out of college, the first grade teacher had been hired the previous August, and Adam Jordan hadn't been the same since. He'd done everything he could think of to attract her attention. But according to rumor, he hadn't yet asked her out on a date.
Naturally, he had no way of knowing that she always throws her car keys under the front seat, Frank explained. Why in heaven's name would she do something like that? Apparently, she picked up the habit from her father. He's got a ranch a ways north of here. Not much concern about theft in these parts.
So Adam was smitten, and the new schoolteacher ignored him. The two of them had become a running joke around town. Adam, for all his skills and talents, didn't know a damn thing about letting a woman know he was interested. The pair of them needed some guidance and good advice, but Davy didn't know who was going to provide it. At one time, that role would have fallen to her, but now, with her antique shop and small tea room doing so well, she already had more than she could handle.
By the way, Frank said, I stopped at the travel agency. Gayla had our tickets.
He slid the airline packet out of his hip pocket and set it on the counter. This European vacation had been planned for months. It was going to be a combination of business and pleasure. Dovey and Frank would spend 2 weeks touring major cities on the continent, purchasing a few antiques and visiting a museum here and there. They considered the trip a honeymoon of sorts, although Frank was quick to insist that their entire marriage had been a honeymoon. Dovey wrapped her arms around her husband. She couldn't wait. They'd talked about this trip for ages, dreamed about it too. Soon they would be seeing exciting museums, shopping for antiques, and enjoying the sights, and each other.
Come to promise.
Annie Applegate repeated Jane's invitation aloud as she drove down the narrow Texas highway toward her new life. Her friends in California thought she was crazy to pack up everything she owned and move to Texas, to a town she'd never even seen. Perhaps they were right, but it felt good to be taking some positive action. When they were teenagers, Jane Dickinson had been one of Annie's best friends. Correction, Dr. Jane Patterson. It was hard to remember that Jane wasn't simply Jane any longer, but a fully certified physician. Not only that, Jane was married, and Annie wasn't. Oh, she had been. But a serious car accident had left her with a permanent limp, and a husband who found himself incapable of loving a woman whose once perfect body was now marred by ugly red scars. No, Annie told herself, she was not going to dwell on Billy, although that vow had become nearly impossible since she'd learned his new wife was pregnant. What hurt most was that Billy knew how much she'd long for a child. Before the wedding, they'd frequently discussed the family they'd have. At least 3 kids close together. Annie had thought of little else but quitting her job at the library and becoming a full-time wife and mother. During the 5 years of their marriage, Billy had put her off with a detailed list of reasons they should wait before starting a family. In retrospect, it was a blessing children hadn't been involved in the divorce. Annie had wanted to put all the pain and betrayal of the marriage behind her.
Make a new life for yourself and promise, Jane had suggested. Our library has a limited budget and is only open part-time. This town needs a good bookstore.
In the weeks since, they'd exchanged countless letters and talked endlessly, running up huge long-distance bills. Her friend had described the people of Promise, the community itself, and her own role as physician in the town's only clinic. Hearing Jane's enthusiasm for Promise, Texas, Annie understood her decision not to return to California. In some ways, Annie already felt part of the community. She knew the town and its history. She knew something about every family in the area. And thanks to Jane, she could almost talk like a Texan. When she reached the town limits, the church steeple was the first thing to catch her attention. The bowling alley was next, then the city park, followed by the post office. It was exactly as Jane had described it. Annie pulled into the bowling alley parking lot and cut the engine. Jordan's Town and Country Western Wear sat on the corner across the street. And there it was, the empty space next door. Annie put down money to lease with an option to buy. Jane had assured Annie this would be the perfect spot for a bookstore. Annie had contacted the rental agent, and they'd quickly reached an agreement. A bookstore was just what the town needed, it seemed, and Annie could think of no better way to invest her insurance settlement. Best of all, there was a small apartment above the store. This was to be Annie's home. Annie climbed out of the car and glanced around, observing the feel of the town. The sun shone brightly for May. Birdsong was all around. It was a nice place, Annie decided. Everything she'd anticipated, and more. Yes, Jane was right. Promise would indeed make her a good home. With that in mind, Annie headed toward the clinic, knowing Jane was awaiting her arrival. As luck would have it, Jane was talking to her receptionist when Annie stepped inside the clinic.
Annie!
Jane hurried toward her, smiling hugely and engulfing her in an enthusiastic hug.
You look wonderful!
So do you, Annie returned in all honesty. Jane was almost 7 months pregnant and looked absolutely radiant. I've got 15 minutes or so between appointments, Jane said, tugging at Annie's hand. Come and meet Dovey, and if there's time, I'll take you over to meet Ellie, and then...
Already? Annie protested,
but not too strenuously. She'd been hearing about the Women of Promise for months. No, years. She couldn't wait to meet them, even if she didn't know how she'd keep them all straight. Dovey baked scones this morning, and I promised Ellie I'd give her a call the minute you got here. Savannah's dying to meet you, too. Annie nodded. She remembered who Savannah was. Dovey, an older woman, owned an antique shop, and Ellie, she recalled, was married to Cal Patterson's brother, Glenn. Moments earlier, Annie had been exhausted, but 5 minutes with Jane and she was raring to go.
I want to see my store as soon as I can. The apartment, too, of course.
Max Jordan has the key for you. That's his Western Wear store. By the way, his son was recently elected sheriff. He's single, if you're interested.
I'm not, Annie assured her, but had to laugh.
It was almost as if they were back in high school. Jane, with her boundless energy for life, was always trying to organize everyone else's lives.
Oh, Annie, you're gonna love it here.
Both her children were down for their afternoon naps, and that meant Savannah Smith had an hour to herself. She poured a cup of tea and reached for the mail. Early afternoon was her favorite time of day. With two children constantly underfoot, it seemed the house was rarely quiet. Not that Savannah had cause for complaint. She adored her children and loved her husband, Laredo, deeply. She sifted through the envelopes, automatically setting aside the bills and tossing the advertisements in the trash. Then she saw it. Her address scrawled in a familiar hand and froze. The letter was from Richard Weston, her brother. The name of the correctional institution was stamped on the back of the envelope, along with a warning that the letter had not been inspected. In the 3 years since Richard had been incarcerated, this was the first letter Savannah had received from him. He wouldn't have written if he didn't want something. She knew that without a shred of doubt. Her younger brother was a constant source of pain to the family. During his last visit to Promise, he'd wrought havoc and brought disgrace into the lives of both herself and her older brother Grady, not to mention the other residents of Promise. Savannah had searched fruitlessly for an explanation, some event in their childhood that had shaped Richard into the man he was now, the thief, the scoundrel, the felon, preying on the weak and the helpless. The first major and truly unforgivable demonstration of Richard's character had occurred shortly after their parents' deaths in a flash flood. The day of the funeral, Richard absconded with the cash their father had left his heirs to cover the hefty inheritance taxes on the ranch. He'd taken the money and simply disappeared. As a result, Grady and Savannah spent years scrimping and sacrificing to hold on to the land that had been in their family for more than 130 years. Savannah never learned what had happened to the $40,000, but guessed that Richard had squandered it, as he had his life. Then one day, 6 years after he disappeared, Richard had mysteriously returned,
full of regret for the pain he'd caused them. At first, he seemed to be his old self again, fun-loving, charming, sociable. Within a few months, though, Savannah had learned the bitter truth. Her brother hadn't changed at all. He disappeared again, owing thousands of dollars to local businesses. This time, he holed up in Bitter End, a ghost town buried deep in the hill country, miles outside of Promise. Not until later did they learn that Richard was on the run from the law. He'd hidden out in Bitter End for weeks, and would have stayed there indefinitely if not for the accident. A stairway had collapsed in one of the old buildings, trapping him. He would have died if he hadn't been discovered by Dr. Jane and Cal Patterson. Nearly dead, Richard had been airlifted to a San Antonio hospital. Once he'd recovered, he was returned to New York to stand trial. He was sentenced to 20 years in a New York State prison. Until today, Savannah had heard nothing from him. Now this. She braced herself emotionally and unfolded the letter. Dear Savannah, I imagine you're surprised to hear from me after all this time. It's taken me this long to come to grips with everything and realize how wrong I was. I never was a quick study, was I? Prison life is even worse than you probably think, but it's what I deserve. I know I've been here nearly 3 years, and I apologize for not writing sooner, but I didn't have the courage to ask you to forgive me. I'd understand if you decide not to answer this, but I hope you will. Could you find it in yourself to bury the past and start again? I'm paying for my crimes, and will continue to pay for the next 22 years. I can't undo the pain I caused you, but I can tell you how truly sorry I am. Write me, Savannah, please. Tell me about yourself and Grady. What's happened to Bitter End? I worry about some of those old buildings, and fear another one might collapse. That place is dangerous and should be shut down. Don't let me down, Savannah. Please answer. I wouldn't ask if it wasn't necessary. You're all I have. Love, Richard. Savannah read the letter a second time, and was so caught up in what her brother had written that she didn't hear the back door open. Savannah, can you? Her husband's words died when he saw her with the letter, tears streaming down her cheeks. What's wrong? Laredo kneeled down in front of her. She lowered her head. It's a letter from Richard. What does he want? She handed him the letter. Savannah watched Laredo's expression as he read, knowing he trusted Richard even less than she did. He set the letter aside. What are you going to do?
I don't know.
Are you going to tell Grady?
I don't know.
Grady has a right to know, her husband reminded her gently.
A right to know what? Grady asked as he stepped into the kitchen. Everything all right?
Grady. Yes. No. Oh, I don't know. Here, take a look at this.
Savannah handed her brother the letter. Grady rapidly read it. As he did, his eyes narrowed, and his face darkened with fury. He looked up as soon as he was finished.
Have you answered him?
Not yet. I just received it today.
Are you going to answer?
Savannah hesitated.
I haven't decided.
Don't. I want nothing to do with Richard. As far as I'm concerned, my brother was dead. If you choose to have contact with him, that is your choice, but I feel obliged to give you fair warning. He's just trying to use you.
He asked us to forgive him, Savannah said.
If Richard's so keen on seeking our forgiveness, why didn't he write me, too?
Savannah couldn't answer that.
Take my advice, little sister. Don't answer that letter.
Grady was well aware of Richard's game. His brother intended to slither back into their lives a little at a time. All he had to do was find an opening, and Savannah, with her soft heart, would no doubt provide it. Then once again, Richard would get what he wanted. And he did want something. Grady would stake his life on it. Veterinarian Lucas Porter leaned against the porch railing, and drank deeply from a glass of iced tea. Ranchers Cal and Glenn Patterson stood next to him, enjoying the peacefulness of the moment. The day had been exhausting, and Lucas was tired to the bone. Tired, but also exhilarated, following the complicated birth of a foal. The mare was a favorite of Cal's, and he'd been worried. Lucas was glad Cal had enough common sense to call him when he did. Another hour, and it would have been out of his hands. "The foal's a real beauty," Cal boasted. "She's something, all right," Lucas couldn't help agreeing. "Aren't you going to call Jane and tell her?" Glenn asked his brother. "Annie'll want to know, too." "Annie, she's the one who's opening the bookstore, right?" Lucas asked. "Yeah," Glenn said. "Friend of Jane's. Cal likes her, so do I. Have you met her yet?" "Not formally," Lucas said. He'd seen her around town a few times. She was tall and fragile-looking. From what Cal had told him, she'd been involved in a car accident a while back, followed by a bad divorce. Apparently, it was the need for a new beginning that had brought her to Promise. New beginnings were something Lucas understood. He'd spent the first 10 years of his life in Promise before moving to Oklahoma City. 4 years ago, following his wife's death from cancer, he'd returned to Promise, seeking a fresh start for himself and his two young daughters, Heather and Holly. Pain tightened his chest at the thought of his wife. Julia had been dead for almost 4 years, but the ache inside him never seemed to diminish. At times, the loneliness was more than he could bear. Lucas pushed away the memories and tried to resume an interest in the conversation.
"Annie's hoping to start a Saturday afternoon storytelling group for kids. You might be interested in that for your girls. She's already got Travis lined up."
Travis Grant was a local writer with a wide national audience for both his children's books and adult adventure series. Lucas had been looking for ways to encourage Heather to read, and this sounded perfect. At Cal's mention of the girls, Glenn piped up.
"How's it going with your new housekeeper?"
Lucas shrugged. He paid top dollar for Mrs. Delaney, and found the woman to be adequate but little else. Although Mrs. Delaney was kind enough to his children, she didn't offer real comfort.
"Sometimes I think it'd be easier to find myself a wife."
"Then why don't you?" Glenn asked. "There's got to be someone within 100-mile radius who'd be willing to have you."
Lucas slapped his hat against his friend's side, and Glenn laughed. Despite his own grin, Lucas saw no humor in his dilemma.
"Things are bound to get better," Lucas said.
He sounded more certain than he felt.
"Yeah," Glenn concurred, and Cal nodded.
For the sake of his sanity, Lucas hoped his friends were right. Adam Jordan waited a couple of days before apologizing to Jeannie French. He wanted to give her a chance to cool down before he humiliated himself further. He flushed with embarrassment every time he thought about locking her keys inside her car. Parked in his patrol car outside Promise Elementary, Adam waited until the school buses rolled out of the parking lot before heading towards the school. Walking through a side entrance, Adam made his way to the first grade classroom. When he got to the room, he glanced inside. Jeannie was busy rinsing paintbrushes at a small sink in a corner of the classroom. Every time he saw her, he found it hard to swallow or even breathe. His instincts clamored that she was the woman he'd been waiting for, a woman to share his life. Adam had never experienced anything close to this kind of feeling. His stomach started acting up. He couldn't sleep, and every ounce of finesse he'd once possessed deserted him. Here he was, a man who could leap out of a plane, rope a calf, and curse in 5 languages. But when it came to asking Jeannie out on a date, he reverted to the insecure teenage boy of 12 years ago. Jeannie must have felt his scrutiny because she turned around and met his look, mild surprise showing in her eyes.
"Hello again," Adam said.
"Sheriff Jordan."
She glanced away as if she wasn't completely comfortable around him. After everything that had happened, Adam didn't blame her. He stepped into the room prepared to begin his apology.
I want to let you know how sorry I was for causing you any inconvenience. With your car, I mean."
"You couldn't possibly have known I'd tossed the car keys under the driver's seat. It's a dumb habit, I know." She seemed to be waiting for him to leave.
Instead, Adam walked between a row of impossibly small desks and sat down.
Since you're new, I wasn't sure anyone told you the sheriff's office generally meets with the elementary students every year. I'll be making an appearance within the next month or so.
Oh, well, that's a very good idea.
We want the students to know the sheriff is their friend.
He yearned to tell her he wanted to be her friend as well, but couldn't figure out how to do that without sounding like he was making a pass, which basically he was, only he'd rather not be so obvious about it.
I'm sure the children will enjoy your visit very much. She continued to look as if she was waiting for him to leave.
I hate to be rude, she said after a few moments, but I have a dentist appointment at 4 this afternoon.
Adam's spirits sank. Ask her, his mind shouted. A movie on Friday night, perhaps dinner afterward. Just how difficult could it be to get the words out?
Before you go, I was thinking, no, I was hoping that you'd let me make it up to you, she frowned.
I'm sorry, I don't understand.
Locking your car keys inside your car?
Sheriff, really, it isn't necessary. She refused to meet his eyes, which flustered him even more.
How about dinner on Friday night?
Sheriff,
if not dinner, maybe you'd be interested in seeing a movie? I hope you like butter on your popcorn.
I love buttered popcorn. Her eyes softened with a smile.
Great! He felt like leaping up and dancing around. How about dinner and a movie? I'll pick you up around 5 on Friday and we'll catch the early show at the theater and then go out. Maybe to the Chili Pepper. What do you think?
Oh, Adam.
It was the first time she'd used his given name, and she made it sound like the most incredible name a man could have.
I don't think that's a good idea, she continued awkwardly.
No? Surely there was some mistake.
There's some people who just don't gel together. Certain people who aren't meant to be more than friends. I'm honored that you asked me out, but I just can't see the two of us dating. Don't misunderstand me. I like you.
Obviously not enough.
I'm sorry.
Listen, Jeannie, if you don't want to go out with me, all you have to do is say so. Which she had.
It was Saturday, a beautiful May morning, and Cal and Jane Patterson parked the pickup on Main Street. They simultaneously opened the truck doors and climbed out, gave each other a quick kiss goodbye, then headed in opposite directions. Cal to visit his parents Mary and Phil at their bed and breakfast, and Jane toward Tumbleweed Books to see Annie. The moment Annie Applegate had opened her doors for business, she'd been swamped with eager customers. Jane was delighted to see Annie's venture already a success. Jane chatted with friends and neighbors as she walked down the sidewalk. It seemed every rancher in the area made a trip into town on Saturday morning. Once she was inside Tumbleweed Books, Gina Greenville, the high school girl Annie had hired part-time, rang up the book Jane had ordered, the latest blockbuster by their local writer, Travis Grant. Travis was very much part of the Promise community, and something of a hero. It had been Travis and his wife Nell who'd solved the mystery at Bitter End, the original settlement that had been abandoned in the 1880s and reestablished as the town of Promise. Annie sat in the back of the shop, surrounded by a circle of children for story time. A chapter from Beverly Cleary's book, Ramona the Pest, had the children's rapt attention. Hardly a sound could be heard above Annie's animated voice. Jane hadn't seen her friend look happier or more at peace with herself since their high school days. Among the 10 or 11 gathered there, Jane saw Heather and Holly Porter. They were huddled together close to the front, while their father, Lucas, leaned against the back wall. Jane walked over to Lucas.
How's it going, Dr. Jane? He asked sotto voce.
Great. How about you, Dr. Luke?
Fair to middling.
Your girls certainly seem to enjoy story time.
That's not the half of it. Annie is all they talk about these days. It's Annie this and Annie that. They'd come to the bookstore every day if they could.
It did Jane's heart good to see these two motherless children bond with Annie Applegate. Of all the women in town, Lucas's children had found the one who could really understand them, the one with whom they shared a common experience.
It seemed as though the two little girls intuitively knew that Annie too had lost her mother when she was young. All at once, Jane saw the romantic possibilities between Annie and Lucas. It made sense. They were perfect for each other. She'd invite them both for dinner, she decided, and nudge them in the right direction, just as Dovey and Ellie had once steered her toward Cal.
"Annie's really terrific with kids, isn't she?" Dovey commented, coming up behind her. "I knew this town needed a bookstore, but I had no idea it was going to be this popular."
Jane nodded happily, her eyes connected with Dovey's and held. She pointedly slid her gaze toward Lucas, then Annie. She gave Dovey a moment to catch her meaning, then raised her eyebrows in moot comment. Jane knew the instant Dovey understood. The older woman's mouth formed a small O. Then she winked, letting Jane know she was in full agreement.
"You're right. The girls seem to like Annie," Jane mentioned casually as she sidled closer to Lucas.
Oblivious to what Dovey and Jane were plotting, he nodded.
"You sure everything's okay?" Jane asked.
"At home," Dovey added.
A frown clouded Lucas's face.
"I guess so."
"The new housekeeper's working out?" Jane asked next.
Lucas lifted one shoulder in a shrug. "I imagine you could use a break now and then," she continued.
"Get out, spend some time with another adult," Dovey elaborated.
"Yes, I suppose, but..."
"Have you ever thought of asking Annie out?" Jane asked point blank.
"Out? Like, on a date?"
Lucas sounded as if he'd never heard the word before.
"Why not date Annie?" Jane said quickly.
Lucas sent her a stricken look.
"Come on, Lucas. It would do you both good. Annie hasn't taken a break since she arrived last month."
"The girls?
Frank and I would love to have them for the evening," Dovey volunteered.
"Cal and I would too," Jane said.
"You would?"
Lucas resembled a man who'd been thrown a lifeline, but didn't know what to do with it.
"Ask her," Jane urged.
"You think I should?"
"Yes. I'm sure Annie would enjoy your company."
"Maybe I should," he murmured, watching Annie.
Jane reached for Dovey's hand and squeezed it hard. She grinned widely. Oh, yes. Lucas and Annie were perfectly suited for each other. It took Lucas almost a week to find the nerve to approach Annie Applegate about dinner. He hated to disappoint Jane and Dovey, those two great romantics, but he wasn't interested in a romantic relationship. Despite what he'd said to Glenn and Cal Patterson a few weeks ago, he wasn't planning to remarry. The truth of the matter was that he was lonely, and though he didn't want a romantic involvement, he did want someone to laugh with, a friend. The problem was, how exactly did a man convey that to a woman without disappointing or insulting her? Still, he had to try. Friday morning, he sat on the edge of his bed, rubbed his face with both hands, and heaved a deep sigh, promising himself he wouldn't put it off any longer. With a sense of resolve, Lucas readied himself for his day, paying extra attention to his appearance. Without giving himself a chance to change his mind, he drove into town, parked his pickup, then quick marched down the street toward the bookstore. He burst inside, determined to be done with this once and for all.
"Annie?"
He hadn't intended to sound quite so demanding or so loud. Belatedly and thankfully, he realized she was alone. Startled, she looked up from the cash register.
"Lucas?"
"No, I mean, yes, it's me, obviously," he groaned inwardly. "She must think I'm an idiot. I was wondering..."
He stopped, not knowing how to proceed. This was even worse than he'd envisioned.
"You were wondering?
Do you like to eat?"
he blurted out, immediately cursing himself for asking such an inane question.
"Eat? Of course. Doesn't everyone?" "The Mexican Lindo. Or what about the chili pepper? And there's always the cafe at the bowling alley."
Her eyes narrowed. "Are you asking me to lunch? Is that what this is all about?"
"No, not lunch."
He snapped before he could stop himself. God help him, he was making a mess of this. All of a sudden, Lucas felt the need to sit down. He sank into one of the overstuffed chairs Annie had placed throughout the store. Hoping to make a fresh start,
He ran his hands through his hair and inhaled deeply.
Annie, I apologize. I'm making a fool of myself. It's been a long time. Years. I wouldn't blame you if you decided you never wanted to lay eyes on me again. But in case you do, how about dinner?
Her smile was warm and forgiving. I think that would be wonderful.
You do? You'll go?
He bounded to his feet.
Great, that's really great!
Feeling jubilant, he headed toward the glass door.
Lucas?
Annie stopped him. He turned back.
Is there any particular night you'd like to go?
Is it all right if I get back to you? There's some other stuff I'd like to talk to you about as well.
In light of how poorly this had gone, it seemed best to wait before he introduced the just friends idea.
Sure.
You won't change your mind.
Not unless you do.
Lucas rolled his eyes. Trust me, after all this, it ain't likely.
Dovey couldn't believe everything that needed to be done before she and Frank left for Europe. Although Nessa Boyd, Dovey's sister-in-law from her first marriage, had agreed to fill in for Dovey at the shop and was helping her get ready. Appointments, errands, and deadlines crowded on top of one another and threatened to overwhelm her.
You look exhausted, and you haven't even packed yet,
Nessa commented when she entered the shop that morning.
I am exhausted, Dovey confessed.
She poured them each a cup of tea and placed her feet on the chair across from her.
Oh, Dovey, you're going to have the time of your life. Think about it, Paris, London, Amsterdam.
Dovey knew Nessa was right. She should be excited, happy. But she wasn't. She was tired. Nessa had been a godsend. A year earlier, her sister-in-law had returned to Promise after a long absence. In their 20s, Nessa and Dovey had been as close as sisters. But then Leon, Nessa's husband, and Dovey's first husband's brother, had started work for one of the big oil conglomerates, and the couple had traveled all over the world. Their three children, now grown, had settled in different parts of the country. Shortly before he was due to retire, Leon suffered a heart attack and died. Nessa hadn't known what to do with herself afterward, so she had gone to live with her oldest daughter, Sylvia, in New Orleans. Judging by the phone calls Dovey had received from Sylvia, all three children obviously thought Nessa was incapable of making her own decisions, that she was the type of woman who needed a man in her life. But Nessa wasn't. Dovey had rarely met a woman as capable as her sister-in-law. Sylvia began to suggest that Nessa remarry. She had even begun lining up men for Nessa to meet, when, much to Sylvia's distress, Nessa decided to move back to Promise. Dovey was delighted she had.
I've got so much to do, Dovey said, her head full of all the tasks she had yet to complete.
I'll help. Why do you think I'm here? Nessa assured her. You haven't got a thing to worry about.
Annie was surprised by how much she was looking forward to her luncheon date with Lucas Porter. Because of their busy schedules, it seemed impossible to find an evening they were both free. Her free time coincided with his only once, on Wednesday afternoon of the following week. So they agreed to meet for lunch. By 1 o'clock, when she joined him at the Chili Pepper, Annie was nervous and uneasy. She could see he was, too. As soon as they'd been seated and ordered their lunch, Lucas began speaking with the manner of a man who has something to get off his chest.
Annie, there's something I need to talk to you about. I don't know what it's been like for you since your divorce, but since Julia died, I've sometimes felt starved for adult conversation, at least conversation that isn't strictly work-related.
It does get lonely.
For me, too. That's why it'd be good to have a friend, someone who appreciates how damn lonely it can get. I'm not looking for anything more.
She nodded, unsure of what else to do. He didn't need to paint her a picture. He wanted a friend. Okay, fine. Someone to talk to. Another adult who understood. She wanted that, too. So she really had no reason to feel disappointed.
I'm not interested in remarrying anytime soon, if that's what concerns you.
You're not? Great.
His relief was evident.
Friends,
she held out her hand for him to shake.
Friends, he said, reaching across the table.
and then suddenly, the tension lifted. Until today's lunch, Annie hadn't quite known what to make of Lucas Porter. She had heard he was a widowed veterinarian and that he'd adored his wife. From what she'd seen of him, he was a good father. His daughters clearly loved him. She'd been worried that they'd spend their entire lunch together talking about his dead wife, her illness, her sterling character, and if not her, the conversation was sure to center on his two daughters. But Annie was wrong. After the initial awkwardness, their discussion during lunch was lively and animated, with a friendly argument or two. Normally shy, Annie was amazed at how much they had in common, and how comfortable she felt with him. Their lunch hour flew, and almost before she was aware of it, they discovered it was time to leave. They continued to talk as he escorted her back to the bookstore. Reluctant to part, they found their steps slowing as they reached the store. "I had a great time," Annie told him at the entrance.
"I'm surprised myself," Lucas admitted, looking mildly guilty.
"So the truth is out. Enjoying yourself came as a shock, did it?" They stood smiling at each other until Annie finally broke eye contact. "Thanks, Lucas."
"Thank you," he said.
Then, almost in afterthought, he leaned forward and, in full view of anyone watching, kissed her cheek. "Friends," he'd said, and she'd agreed. Yet it seemed somehow that they'd already gone beyond friendship. Annie held her breath, hoping he'd ask her out a second time right then and there. He didn't. Instead, he tucked his hands into his pants pockets, nodded, and walked away. Apparently, the interest she felt wasn't mutual. Days like this, it was pure pleasure to be a writer. The words flowed effortlessly onto the computer screen as Travis Grant worked on the latest in his T.R. Grant series. Nell's writing desk was placed against his. That meant they faced each other when they worked on their respective books. After winning first prize in the local chili contest a few years ago and selling the use of her recipe to a restaurant in town, his wife had gathered together her family's favorite recipes. Sometime within the next year, Nell's first Texas cookbook would be published. Travis was very proud of her. The phone on his desk pealed, disturbing Travis's thoughts. He grabbed it rather than risk waking his 2-year-old twins, Diana and Devon, from their nap. "Hello?" he said absently. "Travis, is that really you? My goodness, you sound as if you're in the next room instead of the wilds of Texas." He looked up from the computer at the sound of his ex-wife's voice. It had been months, no, longer, perhaps a year since they'd talked. While the divorce had been as amicable as any divorce was likely to be, he didn't have any reason to keep in touch with Val. He would always be grateful to his ex, though. Indirectly, she was the person responsible for his meeting Nell.
"What can I do for you, Val?
Aren't you going to ask how I am?"
"No."
"Well, then I'll ask you. How is everything?" She wanted something. Travis recognized the slightly pleading sound in her voice. They had been married for 8 years, after all. "You and Nell had twins, right? Boys, girls?"
"One of each," Travis supplied. "Diana and Devon. How's New York?"
"You'd know if you visited more often." After he'd married Nell, Travis had decided to keep his Manhattan condo, but his visits had become few and far between. Once last year and twice the year before. He didn't like being separated from Nell and the children.
"Did you hear Charlie and I divorced last year?"
So Val was already through marriage number 2.
"No, I'm sorry."
"I'm not. I never should have left you." Travis didn't believe her, not for a minute. He'd been a struggling young writer when they first met. She'd recently passed the bar. They'd fallen into bed and then into marriage, far too soon to know their own minds. It had been a stupid mistake on his part, one he'd paid for dearly in the years that followed. Val had scorned his writing and his chances of success, and soon left him for one of the senior partners in her law firm, Charles Langley. A year or so after she'd remarried, Travis's children's book series had begun to succeed beyond his expectations, and certainly beyond hers.
"Did you phone to cry on my shoulder?" he asked.
"Of course," she joked and laughed lightly. "Actually, I do have another reason."
"I thought you would."
Do you and Nell still have that dude ranch?
Why?
He hated to sound suspicious, but he simply didn't trust Val. I was thinking of taking a small vacation and visiting your area.
You're coming to Texas? Whatever for?
I need some time away.
And you're certainly taken with the great state of Texas. I figured I'd have a look for myself.
I was hoping you'd be willing to rent me a room.
I don't think it's a good idea for you to come to Promise.
No way in hell did he want Val anywhere near Nell and his family. The two women had never met, and that was the way Travis preferred to keep it.
But I want to see the hill country. I want to see Bitter End, the inspiration for your latest book,
Val puffed, the way she always did when she was intent on getting her own way. It astonished Travis that he could ever have thought himself in love with this woman.
Goodbye, Val, he said firmly.
I'll phone back in a couple of days.
He heard her words as he replaced the receiver.
That was Val?
Travis glanced up to find Nell framed in the doorway. She was a large woman, tall and big-boned, but graceful. From the beginning, he'd seen real beauty in her strong features and honest expression. It seemed a miracle that they'd found each other. He'd been soured on love and marriage. Nell was a widow who'd still grieved the only man she'd ever loved. Nell and her family had welcomed him into their home on a stormy night, his first night in Texas.
She wants to visit. Furthermore, she wants to rent a room from us.
I see, Nell said. Travis stood and walked across the room and drew Nell into his embrace.
What'd you tell her? She asked, wrapping her arms around his neck.
I wanted to suggest she take a flying leap and...
Travis! He sighed deeply.
I urged her to play tourist somewhere other than Promise.
Then he kissed his wife, his lips lingering on hers.
I think we should let her stay here.
You're joking, right?
I've never met Val.
I'd rather keep it that way.
We owe her.
If she hadn't represented Richard Weston, you'd never have come to Texas. Val had been the attorney assigned by the court to defend Richard, who had told her an incredible story about a ghost town called Bitter End. Val had passed it along to Travis, one of the few favors she'd ever done him.
It happened that Travis had been plotting a book around a ghost town at the time, so he'd gone to interview Richard. Weston had fed him a convoluted story about the town and some buried treasure. Travis had listened skeptically, but in the end he had indeed discovered treasure in Promise. He'd met Nell and fallen in love.
I don't mind Travis, Nell assured him.
You actually want to meet her?
Nell smiled and nodded.
You love me, don't you?
You know how much.
Then there's nothing to be afraid of. Duffy and Frank hadn't been gone 2 days, and already Nessa felt right at home running Duffy's antique store. She handled the customers and their requests very nicely, if she did say so herself. On the morning of the third day, the bell above the door sounded, and a distinguished-looking older man entered the shop.
Good afternoon, Nessa greeted him.
Good afternoon, he returned. He glanced about the shop with interest and obvious approval.
Can I help you find something?
Nessa asked, walking toward him.
I'm looking for Dovey.
I'm sorry, but Dovey's traveling in Europe.
Oh, I did try to phone, but when I couldn't reach her, I thought maybe the shop hadn't opened yet, and...
Is there anything I can do for you?
He glanced toward the tea room.
A cup of something hot would be wonderful.
She gestured to the small group of tables.
I was about to sit down myself. In fact, the water's just boiling for tea. Would you join me? I'm Nessa Boyd, by the way.
Dovey's sister?
Dovey and I are... We're sisters-in-law.
Our late husbands were brothers. Nessa poured the steaming water into an antique spode pot and carried it to the table with a plate of Dovey's special peanut butter cookies.
I'm Gordon Pauling, he said. Dovey and I met a few years back on a cruise.
Tell me, did Dovey marry her sheriff friend?
Yes, more than 3 years ago.
Frank and Dovey are vacationing in Europe, and I'm watching the shop while they're away.
Gordon looked taken aback.
Good grief, it has been that long, hasn't it? I'm in San Antonio for a few days for a conference, international law, and remember Dovey. I had the day free,
and when I wasn't able to reach her by phone yesterday, or this morning, I decided to take a chance and come anyway.
I know Dovey will be pleased you visited, Nessa assured him. I do hope you'll take the time to see Promise. It really is a lovely town.
They continued to chat with one another. In the course of their conversation, Nessa learned that Gordon was a retired judge from Toronto, Canada. He'd been invited to the legal conference to participate on a panel. He was a widow with one son who was the same age as Nessa's daughter, Sylvia. They chatted for what seemed to be only moments, but when Nessa glanced at the time, she was stunned to realize it was half an hour past closing. She finished telling him about Frank and Dovey and describing their small wedding.
Now my children seem to think I should follow Dovey's example and remarry, she added wryly.
Gordon carefully returned his cup to the saucer. What is it with children these days? My own son has been harping on that very subject. He was the one who insisted I take that cruise in the hopes that I would meet someone.
My daughter Sylvia has already got a whole lineup of men she wants me to meet. I don't understand it. You can't imagine what I went through to convince my own children that I am perfectly capable of taking care of myself.
Your Sylvia has an evil twin in my son. They laughed, and then Gordon glanced at his watch. My goodness, look at the time. I should have left 2 hours ago. There's a banquet I need to attend. I'm going to be late. It was ridiculous to feel this disappointed, but Nessa did. They'd spent nearly 3 hours talking nonstop, and it felt like 3 minutes. She didn't think she'd ever felt this close to anyone this quickly. She walked him to the door and then outside, where he'd parked his rental car, a large luxury model. He hesitated before climbing inside. I haven't enjoyed an afternoon this much in years.
Same goes for me.
It was a pleasure to meet you, Nessa Boyd.
You too, Gordon Pauling.
He got into the car and started the engine. He waved as he headed down Main toward the highway. Nessa waved back. With an unaccountable sense of loss, she watched as Gordon's vehicle disappeared. Adam Jordan's visit to the first grade class at Promise Elementary was scheduled for the last week of school in late May. Adam hadn't seen Jeannie French since he'd asked her out. He'd avoided her, but probably not nearly as avidly as she'd avoided him. Every time he thought of the embarrassing things he'd done in her presence, he felt sick at heart. The first time they'd met, he'd been following her down a flight of stairs and inadvertently stepped on the hem of her dress. If not for his quick reflexes, she would have fallen. Her skirt had ripped, too. And not so long ago, he'd walked up behind her at the post office. He hadn't meant to frighten her, but when she turned around and found him there, she gave a small yelp, and her mail went flying in every direction. And then he tried to ask her out. Well, that had failed miserably, too. The fates had made it clear. They weren't to be together. He was to look elsewhere, forget her. And yet, despite the little voice in his head that warned him steer clear of Jeannie, Adam's thoughts drifted to the cattleman's dance that was coming up in June. One thing was certain. If he didn't ask her to the cattleman's dance, someone else would. If she was going to reject him, well, so be it. But he wanted to be the first in line in case she had a change of heart. When Jeannie French saw the afternoon schedule and noticed that Sheriff Adam Jordan would be speaking to her class, her first instinct was to take a day's sick leave. Every time he even came close, something happened. Something ridiculous and embarrassing. She supposed she couldn't blame everything on him, but still, some people just didn't mix, and that appeared to be the case with her and Adam Jordan. Until recently, it seemed that everywhere she went, the sheriff was sure to follow, as the nursery rhyme had it. She'd been flattered he was certainly good-looking, and actually seemed quite nice, but then he'd ripped her skirt, frightened her out of her wits, and locked her keys in the car. It was best to acknowledge that any relationship with Sheriff Jordan was doomed before it started. The morning passed quickly. The minute her first graders were back from lunch, Jeannie found herself watching the clock, knowing the sheriff was due at any time. When he entered the room, the children stared up at him, at his uniform, his weapon, his hat, and their eyes filled with awe, Jeannie walked to the back of the classroom while he reviewed basic safety information. Barely a murmur could be heard. She realized that Adam had become every boy's hero and every little girl's knight in shining armor. She looked at him critically. Yes, as she'd noticed before, he was attractive enough. Very fit, about 6 feet tall, a kind face. She squinted and looked at him a second time, almost hoping she'd feel something, anything. She didn't. When he'd finished, he asked for questions, and the children's hands shot up. The question and answer session continued until the bell rang, signaling the end of the school day. A minute later, the classroom emptied as the children raced toward the waiting buses. So Jeannie found herself alone with Sheriff Jordan yet again. Thank you, she said, knowing she sounded stiff. The children enjoyed your talk. He nodded. Silence again. It seemed so loud she wanted to shout that he should either say something or leave. I have something to ask you. Adam stopped, and his shoulders moved in a deep sigh. He started over. The community has a big dance every June, sponsored by the Cattlemen's Association. Jeannie had heard about it from the other teachers. It was said to be quite the affair. Nearly everyone in Promise made an effort to attend. I know you said you didn't think the two of us gelled. Was that the word? Well, I figure you should go out with me once before you can be sure of that. Jeannie could well imagine what an evening with the sheriff would be like. Unrestrained, awkward, and potentially painful. He'd probably step all over her feet if she danced with him. I will be going to the dance, but... The sheriff's eyes brightened with enthusiasm. Then you'll go with me? Jeannie felt a surge of anger. Why was the man so dense? He made this so damn difficult. Please don't make me say it again, Sheriff. Please don't make me tell you I'm not interested in dating you. Adam's expression tightened. I see. I'll make sure there's no repeat of this. Goodbye, Miss French. Goodbye, Sheriff Jordan. With his head high and his back straight, he walked out of her room. Jeannie should have been glad. He'd promised he wouldn't approach her again, which was the result she'd wanted to achieve. But she didn't. Instead, she felt as if she was the cruelest, most wretched woman on the face of the earth. Lucas held the San Antonio paper in his hands, but he wasn't reading. The dinner dishes were done, and Heather and Holly were in their bedroom playing. He cherished the silence, knowing it wouldn't last. His thoughts had wandered to his afternoon with Annie Applegate the previous week. He hadn't expected to enjoy it as much as he had. Annie had a gentleness about her, and a sincerity. It was easy to see why his girls were so taken with her. He wanted to see her again, yet resisted asking. He wasn't sure why, but it seemed important that he put some distance between them. He didn't want to appear too interested, too eager. But now the perfect opportunity to ask her out again had presented itself. The big cattleman's dance was fast approaching, and Lucas knew he was expected to attend. He'd had a miserable time last year. He'd felt so alone, watching his friends hold their wives on the dance floor. This year, though, things would be different. Lucas would invite Annie. It made perfect sense. They understood each other. They'd each experienced a devastating loss. They had a lot in common. They were friends. Who better to invite to the biggest community event of the year? Lucas reached for the telephone. After connecting with directory assistance, he dialed Annie's home number. Hello? Hello, Annie? It's Lucas calling. Lucas! It's so nice to hear from you. How are you? Oh, just fine. Has anyone mentioned the cattleman's dance to you? Jane said something about the dance. Would you like to go? I was thinking about it. With me? That is, I mean, if you'd rather not, I understand. It'd only be as friends. It's just that... I think that's a lovely idea, Lucas. I'd hate going by myself and being the odd one out. His relief was so great he nearly laughed out loud. Thank God. Only, she added. His spirits took an immediate dive. What? Lucas, I don't dance very well because of the car accident. Don't worry about it, Annie.
In fact, we don't even have to dance. Annie's laugh was almost musical.
Damn, and I was hoping we could whirl around the floor barefoot and wild.
The image of the pair of them shoeless in the middle of the dance floor made Lucas smile as he said goodbye and hung up the phone. Not until he readied himself for bed did he notice he was still smiling. He read for a while, then turned out the light. The darkness and silence settled in around him. He waited, as he did every night since Julia died, for the loneliness to come crashing down on him. Tonight, it didn't. In the next few weeks, every time Nessa thought about her afternoon with Gordon Pauling, a feeling of warmth came over her. It had been like a reprieve, a time out of time. She'd felt briefly as if the problems facing her had melted away and she was young again. She hadn't heard from him since, and suspected she wouldn't, if only he hadn't left in such a rush, if only they'd been able to exchange addresses, if only. One morning, when Nessa was counting out cash for the register, the phone rang. Absently, she reached for it.
Davy's Antiques?
Is this Nessa? Nessa's hands went slack.
Gordon?
The pounding of her heart was so fierce she hardly knew how she managed to stay upright.
Then you do remember me.
As if she was likely to forget him.
Of course. You're Davy's friend.
I'd like to believe I'm your friend, too.
Oh, you are.
I had the most enjoyable afternoon in Promise. I wanted to thank you for making me feel so welcome.
It was my pleasure.
I would have phoned sooner, but I had to make an unexpected trip to Vancouver. My brother-in-law died suddenly.
Oh, Gordon, I'm so sorry.
Nessa felt a pang of regret, remembering how quickly her own husband's life had been snatched away.
Yes, it was quite traumatic, and a reminder of how precious life is. We shouldn't waste time, not knowing how little time we have.
Nessa heard the pain in his voice.
Actually, losing Paul was what prompted me to call, he continued. I'm not often as comfortable with anyone as I was with you. The truth is I tend to be somewhat reserved, so I have to ask, did you enjoy our afternoon as much as I did?
That afternoon was one of the best I've spent in years. He chuckled warmly.
I haven't stopped thinking about it since.
Me neither.
I want to call you again, Nessa. That is, if you don't mind.
I'd like it very much.
She gave him her home phone number and wrote down his.
Can I phone you at home this evening? Gordon asked.
Please. I'll look forward to hearing from you.
And that was the way it started. From that day onward, they talked every night, precisely at 7.
Nessa felt like a kid again. There didn't seem to be anything they couldn't talk about.
Then 2 weeks after his visit, a few days after they'd begun talking every night, Nessa heard from Dovey.
Dovey, it's so good to hear from you. Where are you?
New York. Frank and I landed earlier this afternoon. We're staying here for the night and then flying into San Antonio first thing in the morning. We'll be back in Promise by nightfall.
How is everything?
Did anything happen while I was away?
Nessa hesitated. Duffy deserved to know that Gordon had stopped by the store to see her.
Nothing out of the ordinary,
Nessa said, berating herself already for her lie of omission. Not until the line had been disconnected did she admit to being jealous. Her feelings were silly and irrational. Duffy was far more than her relative. She was her friend. Her closest friend. She had every right to know that Gordon Pauling had been in town to see her, except that Nessa hadn't told her. But she would, Nessa promised herself. The next time she saw Dovey, she'd tell her everything.
The castles in the Loire Valley, Dovey said, closing her eyes as if she were visiting them all over again. Nessa, I swear, I've never seen anything more spectacular in my life.
Dovey hadn't stopped talking all morning about the trip.
I don't know why Frank and I waited as long as we did. And the antiques! Oh, Nessa, it was like walking through the doors to paradise.
She closed her eyes once again and smiled ruefully.
I'm making a nuisance of myself, aren't I?
Nonsense!
Nessa enjoyed Dovey's bubbling enthusiasm
and if she wasn't responding as excitedly as her sister-in-law thought she should, there was a good reason. While Dovey was talking, Nessa was trying to find a way to tell her about Gordon's visit. Dovey sighed, then shook her head.
Time to get back to the real world. I can't thank you enough for taking such good care of the shop while I was away.
It was my pleasure, Dovey. I mean that. Nessa inhaled deeply, her hands tense at her sides. It was now or never.
Actually, while you were away, I met a friend of yours. Well, more of a former friend. Someone you might even have forgotten.
The phone rang just then, and Dovey whirled around to reach for it. By the time she was off the phone, a customer had entered the shop. And so it continued for the next couple of hours. Whenever Nessa tried to get up the nerve to say something about Gordon, someone or something would interrupt. Nessa left the shop mid-morning and spent the rest of the day berating herself for being a sneak. She wished desperately that she'd mentioned Gordon's visit when Dovey had phoned from New York. Because she hadn't, the entire episode had taken on gigantic proportions in her mind. But by the afternoon, Nessa had reasoned it out and was content once again. Dovey was happily married. She wouldn't care if Nessa and Gordon were friends. And since it made no difference one way or the other, Nessa saw no rush to tell Dovey. Since she'd delayed this long, a bit longer shouldn't matter.
"What's the matter, Daddy?"
Heather asked Lucas as he placed the dinner plates in the dishwasher. Holly gazed up at him.
"Are you sad, Daddy?"
Lucas wasn't aware his worries were this noticeable to his children.
"Miss Delaney is moving to Kansas to live with her son," he told his daughters.
The housekeeper had given her notice that night when he got home. What on earth would he do now, especially with school out for the summer? If the housekeeper left promise, she wouldn't be there to look after them.
"We know who we want to be our new housekeeper,"
Heather said as she carried her empty milk glass from the table. This was encouraging news. Perhaps the girls knew about someone he didn't. A school friend's mother or older sister.
Who?
"Annie!"
Heather shouted gleefully.
"Annie!"
Holly chorused. Lucas's spirits sank so low they nearly hit the kitchen floor. This entire situation was impossible.
"We like Annie more than anyone around here," Holly said. "She reads real good. If she was the housekeeper, she could tell us a story every day."
Lucas tried to find a way to explain to his daughters why Annie couldn't be their housekeeper.
"Well, Annie has a job, you know, a job that's very important to her. She runs the bookstore, and that means she has to work every day."
Heather regarded him thoughtfully.
"Could Annie be our new mother, then?"
Holly's eyes instantly lit up.
"Could she, Daddy? Could she?"
I don't think so.
"Why not?"
they asked in unison.
"Well, because..."
"We like her better than any lady in the whole world, not including Mommy and Grandma Porter,"
Heather said.
"Yes, but..."
"Will you think about it?"
Heather asked, pleading with him.
"This isn't like getting a toy from the toy store," he said, wondering why he bothered trying to explain. "Annie has other plans for her life."
"But we want her,"
Holly said in that matter-of-fact way of hers.
"Promise you'll think about it, Daddy,"
Heather said again.
"Please?"
He'd think about it, all right, for 2 seconds.
But despite his intentions to dismiss his children's idea, over the next few days, Lucas found himself thinking about it constantly. And the more he thought about it, the better it seemed. It was the day of the cattleman's dance, a day that dragged by slowly. Annie hadn't seen or talked to Lucas since he'd called to invite her. Sometimes she'd wondered if she'd imagined the entire conversation. But he'd left a message on her answering machine, saying only that he'd pick her up at 6. By 6 o'clock the night of the dance, Annie was eager to see Lucas again. He rang her bell and smiled when she opened the door. She liked the look in his eye when he saw her. Her dress was new and expensive, and the way his eyes widened with appreciation made it worth every budget-crushing penny.
"Would you mind very much if we talked before heading over to the dance?"
He seemed nervous, almost ill at ease. "Of course I don't mind. Come on in. Would you like a cup of coffee or a glass of wine?" He shook his head as he walked into her tidy living area, then restlessly paced the room. "What's wrong?"
It seemed to her something must be. Nothing. I have a question to ask you, he said at last. Ask away, I promise not to bite your head off. His face relaxed in a smile. That's good, because you might not think that once I... He hesitated, shook his head. I wasn't going to do this. It would have been much better to wait until after the dance. But I realized as I was walking up the stairs that I couldn't. The whole night would be miserable if I didn't get this off my chest right away.
It's all right, Lucas, really.
He nodded and seemed to gather his nerve. You're going to think this whole idea is ridiculous. I mean, we hardly know each other, but I thought maybe you and I...
Thought what?
I've advertised for a housekeeper.
You want me to give up the bookstore and become your housekeeper?
No, I can hire someone to clean my house, but I can't hire anyone to love my children. Not the way you seem to. And they love you. I've never seen anything like it. From the moment you moved to town, Heather and Holly knew.
Knew what? Annie's head snapped up.
They want you for their stepmother. I can only imagine what you must be thinking, and frankly, I don't blame you. I told you I didn't want anything more than friendship, and I don't. We barely know each other. It's too soon. I still love Julia, and you've just come out of a disappointing marriage. People will think we're both nuts.
He closed his eyes and shook his head as if he could hardly believe what he was saying.
Annie felt numb. This had to be a joke.
Are you asking me to marry you, Lucas?
He glanced away. Pretty pathetic proposal, isn't it?
Annie wasn't going to lie to him.
Yes? I apologize, Annie. I don't have any excuse for approaching you like this.
Annie stood. Do you still want to go to the dance?
He looked up at her and nodded. Slowly he came to his feet. Annie reached for her purse and together they headed for the door. He didn't speak again until they were outside. Naturally, it'd be a marriage of convenience.
Your convenience, you mean?
She wasn't being rude, only truthful.
He opened the passenger door of his truck and paused. You're right. But Annie, I'd do whatever was necessary to make this marriage worthwhile for you, too. My children need a mother, and I need a friend. Someone to come home to in the evenings, someone to talk to at the end of the day. I have no right to ask you something like this, I'm well aware of that. But we could make it work. I know we could.
You mean that?
You'd do what you could to make this marriage worthwhile for me? Annie asked.
Anything. His gaze was intense.
Is there something I can do for you, Annie?
She accepted his hand and climbed into the truck cab. As a matter of fact, there is. He held her look, waiting, wondering.
I want a baby, Lucas. If you agree to give me a baby, then I'll marry you.
In the days that followed Sheriff Jordan's visit to the school, Jeannie French found herself thinking about him more and more often. She knew that discouraging Sheriff Jordan's romantic interest in her had been the right thing to do, although it hadn't been easy. Nevertheless, the look on his face when she'd turned down his invitation to the cattleman's dance haunted her. On the day of the cattleman's dance, Jeannie, for reasons she could not fathom, paid special attention to her hair and makeup. She knew she wanted to look good, although she really wasn't sure who she was trying to impress. She left for the dance feeling nervous and agitated. Thoughts of Sheriff Jordan played in her head. It came as a great surprise to Jeannie when she realized she was actually looking forward to seeing him. The hall where the dance was being held was crowded when Jeannie arrived. Most of the townspeople were either on the dance floor or standing around the edges watching. Tables and chairs were scattered about the room, but each one seemed filled to capacity and beyond. She spotted some of her colleagues at a table and strolled over. Her friends and fellow teachers good-naturedly shifted their chairs to make room for her at the table. As she watched people dance, she caught sight of Adam Jordan. He was dancing with someone she didn't recognize and seemed quite agile on his feet. The woman with him seemed captivated by whatever he was saying.
She was pleasantly surprised when someone asked her to dance, but the music was so loud that other than getting the man's name, Jeannie couldn't talk to him. When the song ended, they applauded politely. Jeannie was just sitting down when a ruckus broke out not far from their table. She turned around to see two men nose to nose, both red-faced and furious.
"Let's settle this outside," one shouted. "Fine with me," the other shouted back.
"But not with me," Adam Jordan said, stepping forcefully between the two men.
"The problem is no one bothered to ask me, and I object strongly. In fact, I've made it my mission to be sure everyone gets along and has a good time this evening. Are we all clear on this, gentlemen, or do we need to discuss it further at my office?"
Adam was ignored as completely as if he'd never spoken. One of the men lunged toward the other. With one quick, graceful movement, Adam stopped his forward progress. At that very second, the other man pulled out a knife. Jeannie cried out as he swung the blade at Adam.
Whatever Adam did, he had the man lying flat on the floor almost immediately. Soon the knife was out of his hands and replaced with handcuffs.
Jeannie couldn't take her eyes off him. This was Adam Jordan? The same man who couldn't utter a complete sentence in her company? Tonight she'd certainly seen a different side of him. For the rest of the evening, Jeannie watched him. Not once did he look in her direction, though. Not once did he give any indication he even knew she was there.
He seemed to dance with every woman present, but not with her.
When a lady's choice was announced, Jeannie shocked herself by boldly crossing the room to Adam's side. "Sheriff?" He looked at her as if he didn't know who she was. "Would you like to dance?" she asked, hardly able to believe her nerve. Wordlessly, he led her onto the dance floor. His hold was loose, and he gazed somewhere over her shoulder. He didn't speak once during their dance. Jeannie wished he'd relax, but he held himself stiffly away from her. When the music ended, she wanted Adam to ask her to dance the next round with him. Instead, he politely brought her back to her table.
"Adam!"
she called out impulsively, stopping him as he turned to leave. His smile unnerved her as he turned back.
"Don't worry, Jeannie. You've done your duty."
Having said that, he turned and walked away. Sunday morning after the dance, Annie Applegate lay in bed and thought about what she'd done. She'd agreed to marry a man she didn't know, a man who didn't love her. She expected in the clear light of day to feel some regrets. To her astonishment, she didn't. She accepted the proposal of a man who was looking for a companion and a mother for his children. It had seemed a straightforward arrangement until she'd complicated it by asking him to get her pregnant. He'd said nothing about sharing a bed. She'd, in effect, made it a condition of the marriage. But more than anything, she wanted a baby, and Lucas had agreed to be the father. Annie hadn't told anyone, not even Jane. Last night, Lucas hadn't mentioned the wedding again until the end of the evening, and then he suggested they seek out Wade McMillan, the town pastor. They'd managed to corner the pastor by himself, and if he was surprised by their news, he didn't let it show. The short conversation ended with Wade making an appointment with them for Monday afternoon. Annie supposed that some ministers might refuse to marry them. Their marriage agreement was unusual. But she sensed Wade understood that they were two lonely, hurting people, seeking to find solace in each other. They weren't in love, but they respected and cared for each other, and both wanted the best for Lucas's children. Besides, Annie had married for love the first time, and the feeling hadn't lasted. Monday afternoon, Lucas showed up at the bookstore a full hour before their scheduled appointment with Reverend Wade McMillan. "Hello," she said as he walked in. Countless questions had chased through her mind since Saturday night, and all she could think to say was, "You're early."
"I know. I just want to make sure you're still willing to go through with this."
"I'm willing. Are you?" He nodded firmly.
"I'm not sure it was a good idea to say anything this soon, but I told the girls. They're thrilled."
"I am too. I'm grateful, Annie. Incredibly grateful."
"Me too," she smiled.
"Have you given any thought to when you'd like the wedding?"
They'd already agreed it would be a small private wedding.
"No, have you?"
Lucas shrugged.
Is 2 weeks enough time for you?
Sounds all right with me, if it is with you.
That's plenty of time for me.
Heather and Holly will be there, won't they? Annie asked, wanting to make the girls feel part of things.
I'd like them to be, if you're okay with it.
Annie nodded, smiling. But then a look of discomfort crossed Lucas's face. He reached for her hand, raising her fingers to his lips.
There's just one more important thing I have to say to you. He looked completely miserable. I want us to do this more than anything, but I can't vow to love you. I can't stand in a church and before God promise you something that isn't possible. I have little enough to offer you as it is, but I refuse to mislead you. I'll never love you. Not the way you deserve, Annie. I buried my heart with my wife.
I see, she whispered. The smile faded from her face. But I will cherish and honor you as my wife. I'm willing to commit my life, my resources, and my future to you. Is that enough? She looked into his eyes, her face serious. It's enough. She'd heard all the words about love before, and they'd been hollow. To anyone else, it might seem she was being cheated, but Annie felt no such loss.
You won't be sorry, Annie, Lucas promised. I'll do everything in my power to be a good husband to you.
Annie believed him.
Mother, are you seeing someone?
Sylvia had arrived unannounced at lunchtime, highly unusual for the middle of the week. Nessa didn't know what she'd said during their last phone call to raise her daughter's suspicions, but whatever it was had Sylvia packed and on the road within 24 hours.
Seeing someone, dear? Mother, please. Either you've met someone or you haven't.
What makes you ask?
Well, for one thing, your phone's busy for practically an hour every evening. For another, you've been acting strange.
Is the latter an observation or a criticism? Nessa asked, rather enjoying this short exchange. Unnerving her daughter wasn't an everyday occurrence. After weeks of listening to Sylvia campaign for the idea of remarriage, Nessa had come to a rather startling conclusion. Her daughter did want her to see men, but only men she'd selected herself.
Just answer the question, Mother.
Have I met someone?
Yes, Mother.
Sylvia, sweetheart, I've met any number of people since moving back to Promise.
A man, Mother. I mean a man.
Several.
Is there any particular man you've met? One you're...
Sylvia's mouth twisted as she said the word.
Attracted to?
Gordon. Oh, my, yes. Their telephone conversations continued on a nightly basis, sometimes lasting as long as 2 hours. If it wasn't happening to her, Nessa wouldn't have believed any couple could have this much to say on such short acquaintance. Nessa lived for his calls. Her entire day was focused on hearing his voice. She felt young again, young and vibrant, in love. The thought brought her up short.
My goodness, it was true. She'd fallen in love with Gordon.
Mother,
Sylvia insisted louder this time.
My goodness, what's come over you?
Nothing, dear.
Nessa's face felt warm and her hands cold. Sylvia gave her a hard look, but finally stopped the incessant questioning.
I was thinking of doing a little shopping this afternoon, she said.
That's nice, dear. Be sure to go see your Aunt Dovey.
I will. Sylvia's expression was grave, and before long she left the house. As soon as she did, Nessa sighed in relief. My goodness, Sylvia was a troublesome child.
Dovey was humming to herself as she lifted the pie plate with one hand and ran a knife around the edge, cutting off any crust draping over the sides.
apple and date pie, made with her buttermilk crust, was one of Frank's favorites, and she was planning to surprise him. The doorbell chimed, and Dovey set aside the pie to answer it.
"Sylvia!"
Dovey let out a cry of delight, and the two hugged for a long moment. Never having had children herself, Dovey cherished Nessa's oldest daughter. She disagreed with the way Sylvia treated Nessa these days, but that was between mother and daughter, not aunt and niece.
"How are you, Aunt Dovey?"
Sylvia asked as she followed her back into the kitchen.
"Never better."
Dovey slid the pie inside the preheated oven and put on water for tea.
"Your mother said you were here for a quick visit."
"I'm heading home tomorrow morning."
"I'm so glad you took the time to come by. I don't see you often enough."
"Aunt Dovey, have you noticed anything strange about my mother lately?"
"What do you mean by strange?"
Sylvia took her time answering.
"She's happy."
"Being happy shouldn't be considered strange, nor is it a matter for concern."
"Have you looked at her lately? Really looked? She's always wearing a silly grin. That's not like her."
"Now that you mention it,
Nessa does seem brighter, more energetic." "That's what I thought. It involves a man. I just know it. Has she mentioned anyone?"
Dovey thought about the past few times she'd seen Nessa.
"No, I can't say she has."
"That's what I thought," Sylvia muttered darkly.
"My dear child, what exactly are you upset about?" Dovey asked.
"Aunt Dovey, don't you know what this means?
My mother's having an affair!"
Affair. The words seemed to hang there between them.
"Don't be ridiculous, child," Dovey chastised. She was sure Nessa was doing no such thing.
"Mark my words, Aunt Dovey," Sylvia said. "She's seeing someone she doesn't want us to know about. He must be married. What other reason could she have for not telling us?"
Sheriff Adam Jordan's days off often fell in the middle of the week. He'd developed a habit of checking the movie schedules every Wednesday. If something new was playing that he particularly wanted to see, he often went to the early evening show. He wasn't as interested in this week's movie as he was in a couple of hours' distraction. He was still thinking about the previous Saturday, and how shocked he'd been when Jeannie French invited him to dance. Adam wasn't all that fond of dancing, but he made a point of partnering as many women as he could for a spin around the floor. It was either that or spend the entire evening ogling Jeannie. He'd never seen her look more beautiful. Apparently, it was his lot in life to get stuck on a woman who wanted nothing to do with him. Since that night, all he'd done was think of her. He needed a distraction, so an afternoon at the movies suited him just fine. Ticket in hand, Adam purchased a bag of buttered popcorn and a tall drink, then headed into the air-conditioned theater. Carrying his snacks, Adam discovered the theater completely unoccupied. He had settled in his seat when the doors opened and a second person entered. A woman, he noted absently, taking a sip of his drink. Not until she walked past him did Adam recognize Jeannie.
"Jeannie," he said aloud,
then wished he could take back her name. So much for playing it cool. So much for acting nonchalant. Blurting out her name in a surge of sheer joy wasn't going to impress a woman who'd made her views on dating him extremely clear. Painfully clear.
"Hello, Adam,"
she said, looking equally delighted to see him. That was a switch. When no one immediately joined her, he looked over his shoulder, finding it difficult to believe she was alone. She hesitated, then sat two rows ahead. With the entire theater empty, she'd chosen to sit almost directly in front of him. Was this a signal? Was this a way of letting him know she regretted her previous attitude? Adam was going to risk asking her.
"Want a milk dud?"
she twisted around to ask. His mouth was full of popcorn, so he shook his head.
"I was hoping you'd save me from eating them all myself. I can do without the extra fat.
Actually, I much prefer popcorn,
but milk duds are the lesser of two evils.
Buttered popcorn?
Buttered.
Adam wasn't sure what possessed him. He knew he'd kick himself later, but he stood up, carrying the bucket of popcorn and the drink, and moved down to her row.
Jeannie smiled as he took a seat next to her.
I've come to rescue you, he said.
Rescue me?
From eating the milk duds. If you're going to consume unwanted calories, make it something you truly enjoy.
She seemed about to argue, then suddenly said, You're right.
Grinning, he tilted the popcorn in her direction.
Jeannie helped herself to a handful, then savored each kernel.
The theater darkened, and the movie began. The movie was undeniably silly, and Adam howled with laughter. Jeannie did too. Soon the popcorn disappeared,
and not long after, the end flashed across the screen.
Then the lights came on,
and they glanced at each other, self-consciously. Still, neither Adam nor Jeannie made any attempt to get up.
That was great, Adam said, and he wasn't referring just to the movie.
This was what he'd envisioned a date with Jeannie would be like. Laughing together, enjoying each other's company. It had happened by accident. However, he wasn't sure what to suggest next, if anything.
I haven't laughed this hard in months, she said. Adam finally stood. Good seeing you again, he said casually.
You too. Jeannie got to her feet as well, but neither made a move toward the aisle.
I'd better be going now. He muttered.
Yeah, me too.
Adam forced himself to turn and start out of the theater, determined not to look back.
Adam?
He whirled around at the sound of her voice, cursing himself for looking so eager.
Adam, listen. You and I got started off on the wrong foot, it seems. I was thinking maybe, you know, we could be friends.
He thought about it for a moment. She'd opened the door, but not damn near far enough. Friends. She wanted to be friends? No thanks, Jeannie.
No?
She looked stunned.
But I hoped.
He'd also hoped, and it had been a disaster. You see, I want the popcorn, too. I'm afraid I'm not interested in the milk duds. Adam could tell from her frown that she didn't understand.
I hate it when people talk in riddles, she said. I can't figure them out.
You will, he told her. Then he turned and strolled away. Gordon Pauling was as giddy as a schoolboy. It had been 15 years since his wife's death, and he'd never expected to fall in love a second time, certainly not this late in life.
He felt so young. So happy now.
Since meeting Nessa, he felt full of purpose. He had a reason to get out of bed in the morning. He greeted each day with a sense of anticipation. Their telephone conversations had become his secret addiction. It had become essential to him to spend part of every day with her. Dad? Miles, Gordon's son, walked into the den, surprising him. I thought you must be home, but you didn't answer the door. I didn't hear it. Caught up in his reveries as he was, the sound of the doorbell must have escaped him. Sit down. Is something on your mind? Work. Kids. Miles leaned his head back against the cushion and closed his eyes. There just don't seem to be enough hours in the day. I need a vacation. Take one, Gordon advised. It'll do you good. Karen, too. I was thinking the same thing.
You enjoyed the cruise you took a few years back, didn't you?
Very much. Didn't you meet someone special while you were in the Caribbean? Miles continued, not looking at him. Special? A woman. Oh, yes, Dovey Boyd, Gordon said. From somewhere in Texas, right? Promise, Texas. Why? You really liked her, didn't you? As a matter of fact, I did. Gordon wondered at this line of questioning.
Whatever happened with you and Dovey? Miles persisted. She married the local sheriff soon after she returned from the cruise.
She's married?
Miles straightened, and the sly smile he wore vanished.
Married?
It happens every day, son. People in love get married.
I see. Miles muttered and sadly shook his head.
You were recently in Texas, weren't you?
Last month for that international law conference, Gordon confirmed.
I saw your phone bill lying on your desk. I see that you've been making quite a few calls to Texas as well.
Miles' accusatory tone struck Gordon. Is everything all right, Miles?
You tell me.
What in heaven's name leads you to assume I have a problem? I'm feeling better about life than I have in years.
Then let me be frank. Are you planning an affair with that married woman in Texas?
His mouth was pinched, and his tone was disapproving. Gordon had never heard anything more outrageous in his life.
Have you gone mad?
What else am I to believe?
Gordon nearly laughed out loud when he realized the misunderstanding.
You think I'm involved with Dovey Hennessy, don't you?
It might interest you to know it isn't Dovey I've been phoning every night. My lady friend's name is Nessa Boyd, and she's Dovey's sister-in-law.
Miles glared at Gordon as if he didn't believe him.
Why didn't you mention her before now?
Nessa and I decided not to for the moment.
It's a bit embarrassing to feel this strongly about someone you've spent such a short time with.
Gordon paused when it became apparent Miles wasn't willing to accept his explanation.
I thought you wanted me to see women. Wasn't that the point of sending me on a cruise?
Yes. But I'd prefer if you'd chosen a widow.
Nessa is a widow. Have you had her checked out?
I'm not buying a used car. Gordon's anger turned to fury.
In this day and age, Miles started, but Gordon cut him off.
That might be the way you handle your personal affairs, but I refuse to be involved in anything so underhanded.
Don't be stupid, Dad. She has to know you're a wealthy man.
She knows nothing of the sort.
A muscle twitched in Miles' jaw.
You're going to do it, aren't you?
Gordon glared at his son.
Do what?
Marry her.
Promise me you won't do anything that stupid without talking to me first.
The engagement of Annie Applegate and Lucas Porter didn't come as any surprise to the community of Promise, thanks to Jane, who took delight in being the one to spread the word. People assumed it was a love match, and the jokes about the brevity of their courtship flew fast and furious. Both Annie and Lucas took the teasing in stride. Annie didn't let it bother her, and Lucas didn't either. Other than Reverend McMillan, no one needed to know the details of their agreement. Annie didn't tell anyone. Not even Jane. The 3 weeks between the cattleman's dance and the wedding passed in a blur. Annie sewed identical dresses for Heather and Holly, went shopping in Austin with Dovey and Jane for her own wedding dress, and spent the rest of the time packing up her tiny apartment to be ready to move in with Lucas and the girls. On the day of the ceremony, Annie was performing some last-minute duties at the church when Jane arrived with Cal.
Are you ready?
Annie inhaled deeply.
I think so.
You're beautiful, Jane whispered, hugging her fiercely. Lucas and the girls, along with his parents, arrived next. As soon as Heather and Holly saw Annie, they raced to her side, their new patent leather shoes echoing in the vestibule.
Oh, Annie, you look so pretty,
Heather cried.
So do you, Annie said,
and bent down to hand each girl a small bouquet of pink roses. They were serving as her bridesmaids and looked angelic in their pink floral dresses with wide satin sashes.
Does everyone know where to stand?
Reverend McMillan asked, signaling that it was time to start the ceremony. Annie had chosen not to walk down the aisle. With such an informal wedding, it seemed unnecessary. The small group gathered in front of the church. Annie hadn't paid much attention to Lucas until then. He wore a dark suit and looked wonderfully handsome.
if a little nervous. She could hardly take it in. A few minutes from now, she'd be this man's wife and stepmother to his daughters. At some time in the future, she'd bear his child. From this day forward, Lucas and the girls would be part of Annie's life. "Come to promise," Jane had written all those months ago. "It won't be long before it'll be like home." 2 months after her arrival, and Annie felt she was part of a real family for the first time since her mother died. Jeannie French had hoped Sheriff Jordan would show up at the reception for Annie and Lucas Porter. She recognized that she'd completely misjudged Adam for months because of some trivial incidents and minor accidents. Now she'd ruined any chance with him. What she needed was a way to let Adam know she was interested, that she'd revised her opinion. If he did attend the reception, she might have an opportunity to hint at her feelings. Jeannie was eating a piece of wedding cake when he appeared. Her mouth closed around the plastic fork, and she simply stared. He was standing on the opposite side of the room, wearing his uniform. She wondered why she hadn't noticed earlier how attractive he was. He looked great, masculine and authoritative. He must have felt her gaze because he looked up and their eyes connected. Her heart pounding, she attempted a friendly smile. She made an effort to look casual as she worked her way across the room.
"Been to any good movies lately?"
she asked as she joined him.
"None to speak of. Are you eating Milk Duds or popcorn these days?" Jeannie suspected more was being discussed here than snack food preferences, which was fine with her.
"Popcorn. Butter."
But what she was implying by this statement, Jeannie was unsure. As she'd already told him, she was terrible at word games. So, driven by the need to make herself clear to both of them, she continued.
"Sheriff Jordan, I want to say I'm sorry. You once said you were interested in dating me, and I told you I didn't think that was a good idea. I'm afraid I might have spoken hastily."
She couldn't get much more direct than that. It was up to him now.
He seemed to consider her words. Then he nodded.
"Well then, what are you doing tomorrow?"
She brightened.
"Absolutely nothing."
"Would you like to go to Bitter End with me?"
She nodded, her heart racing.
"I'd love to."
2 o'clock?
2 o'clock.
He nodded again and walked away, unable to erase the grin from his face.
It was all Jeannie could do not to dance a jig.
Sunday afternoon, Adam picked Jeannie up at her small rental house a few minutes before 2. She answered his knock immediately, dressed in jeans that hugged her slender hips and a loose t-shirt.
"I'm ready,"
she said, grabbing her shoulder bag.
"Me too."
But Adam's throat was dry, and his heart was racing as he helped her into his truck.
"I'm so glad I'm finally getting to see Bitter End,"
Jeannie said enthusiastically as they drove out of town.
"The crazy thing is, I must have lived here 3 months before I ever heard of it. I've read extensively about the hill country, but didn't know about the town until one of the children happened to mention it."
Adam was infinitely pleased that he was the one who'd be taking her, although he wasn't sure how effective a tour guide he'd be. The ghost town wasn't a place that especially thrilled him. He'd been to Bitter End any number of times since his return, heard the story behind the ghost town. He loved a good story as much as anyone, but he did think the town was dangerous. The old buildings were made up of stone or wood. Some of them were in deplorable condition. A few of the wooden structures seemed ready to collapse at any time, and while the others were in somewhat better shape, they had their problems. He wondered if Jeannie would be disappointed when she saw the old town, and said as much. Jeannie insisted that Bitter End couldn't possibly disappoint her.
"My minor was history. I tried to research Bitter End when I learned about it.
Naturally, reading Travis's new book helped."
Adam had read Travis's book as well. He'd written a thriller for adults under the name of Travis Grant, a story completely unlike any in his popular children's series. The bestseller had featured an abandoned town similar to Bitter End. It had become an inside joke around Promise. Everyone knew he'd written about their local ghost town, but maintained the secret, as he did, in an effort to keep Bitter End from being commercialized.
"Did you learn anything new?"
Adam asked. "Probably nothing that Travis and Nell don't already know. What I found was mostly on the internet and in a couple of fairly obscure books Annie managed to get for me."
When he reached the turnoff onto the dirt path that led to the town, Jeannie's eyes lit up with interest, making her even more breathtaking than ever. It was all Adam could do to keep his truck on the road. He gripped the wheel more tightly to steady himself. After all these months of seeing Jeannie, of wanting her, and being rejected, this time together didn't seem real. The only thing he could think about was how much he wanted to kiss her. Out of sight of the highway, Adam pulled the truck to a stop and turned off the engine.
"We're here?" Jeannie sat up and glanced about.
"No, not even close. It's a couple of miles yet."
"Then why'd we stop?"
Adam clenched the steering wheel.
"Go ahead and be mad."
"Why would I be mad?"
"Because of what I'm about to do."
Instead of saying anything else, Adam simply pulled her into his arms. He leaned forward, bringing his lips to hers. The kiss was slow and deep, and Adam felt it all the way to the soles of his feet. At last they broke apart, and Adam dragged a deep breath into his oxygen-starved lungs.
"Wow. That was my line," Jeannie whispered. Her eyes were still closed.
Adam's hands trembled as he reached for the ignition key. Jeannie was probably waiting for him to say something. Well, if he could have explained what had prompted this sudden need, he would. As it was, he just kept his mouth shut. Jeannie hung on to the door handle as Adam sped toward the ghost town. The truck bounced over the uneven road, jolting them this way and that, but he didn't slow the pace. When he arrived at the place where they needed to park and continue on foot, Adam noticed another vehicle.
"Someone else is here," Jeannie said. This was the first either had said since the kiss.
"That's Travis Grant's truck."
Adam turned off the engine and walked around the cab to help Jeannie out. His eyes met hers, and when she rested her hands on his shoulders, she smiled.
"Do you want me to apologize for kissing you?"
he asked, needing to know.
"If you do, I'll be furious."
Adam relaxed.
"It would have been a bold-faced lie."
Her smile created dimples on each side of her mouth.
"I'm glad to hear that."
It demanded every bit of restraint he possessed not to kiss her again right then and there. Instead, he took her arm to lead her along the rocky path to the limestone outcropping, from which they could see the town.
"Oh my," she whispered when it came into view.
He moved closer to her and was gratified when she reached for his hand and entwined her fingers with his.
"It's just the way I imagined it would be."
She took a few moments to appreciate the view before heading eagerly down the steep trail. As they descended into the town, Adam saw Nell and Travis wandering among the old buildings.
"Howdy," Travis called.
Adam and Jeannie walked over to meet them in the dusty main street.
"Adam was kind enough to offer me a tour of Bitter End," Jeannie said. "I've never been."
"We're here on another research mission," Nell told them, "although we aren't really sure what we're looking for." Adam was grateful to run into Nell and Travis, who knew much more about Bitter End's history than he did.
"I don't think I'll be able to answer all of Jeannie's questions. She's an amateur historian."
Jeannie dismissed Adam's claim with a wave of her hand.
"I've always been fascinated with the Old West. It's one of the reasons I enjoyed reading Travis's book so much."
"Do you mind telling us about the mystery of Bitter End?" Adam said. "We'd love nothing more," Travis said, smiling. "You already know that Bitter End was settled after the Civil War, right? The pioneers decided to build the town here after a long and difficult journey. Tradition says that's how the town got its name."
Well, for a time, the community prospered. But everything took a turn for the worse when a preacher's son was hanged by a band of drunken men because he tried to protect a saloon girl from their attack. His father came looking for him sometime later, and when he learned what had happened, he cursed the town. No one took him seriously until a series of disasters led the community to believe they were doomed. The people left in a panic, Nell added. They just abandoned the town. Jeannie appeared fascinated by the tale.
That's an incredible story.
Actually, the story I recently read might interest you, if you're not already familiar with it. Have you ever heard of One-Eyed Jack? They all shook their heads.
I came across him in an out-of-print book Annie recently found for me. It seems that this Jack Benson was a Confederate soldier who lost an eye at Gettysburg. Apparently, that was how he got his clever nickname. According to the story, he turned to crime after the war and started running with a gang of misfits and undesirables, spreading havoc across Texas. It's believed he was killed somewhere near Promise in a shootout with Texas Rangers after robbing a Union paymaster.
Fascinating story, Jeannie, Travis said enthusiastically. If you know any more, I'd love to hear them. Old tales like that provide great inspiration for my writing.
You said you were researching another book? Adam asked Travis.
Well, not exactly, the other man answered. He and Nell glanced at each other as if gauging how much to say. Actually, we're more curious than anything else. Someone we know has shown some, shall we say, unusual interest in Bitter End, and we're trying to figure out why.
Another history buff?
No.
Travis appeared certain of that, but appeared unwilling to say any more on the topic.
They continued to exchange stories until what seemed like only moments later, Nell glanced at her watch.
It's nearly six!
Adam was shocked at how quickly the entire afternoon had disappeared. He and Jeannie thanked Travis and Nell and quickly took their leave. Jeannie talked excitedly on the ride back into town. Her enthusiasm for Bitter End was contagious, and Adam soon found himself agreeing to escort her back. But then, he would have been willing to visit the garbage dump if she'd wanted to go there.
Ever since Dovey and Frank had returned from their European vacation, Nessa had avoided her sister-in-law in order to put off telling Dovey about meeting Gordon. Finally, Nessa had to admit to herself that the situation was silly and that she had to say something to Dovey. She waited until Saturday afternoon, when she knew Dovey would be home by herself. She walked over to Dovey's place and knocked on the door, trying to prepare herself for what she had to say. Dovey opened the door almost instantly.
Nessa, come on in. I've hardly seen you in weeks.
She held the screen door wide open, that led her into the kitchen.
Would you like coffee or tea?
Nessa laughed.
I was thinking more along the lines of a rum and coke.
Dovey hesitated.
Any reason you're looking to sample the hard stuff in the middle of the afternoon?
As a matter of fact, there is.
Oh, Dovey, I should have done this long ago.
What is it?
Tell me.
The words tumbled out of Nessa's mouth.
I'm in love with Gordon Pauling.
Dovey frowned.
Who?
Gordon Pauling. You met him on the cruise ship a few years back. He stopped here to see you while you and Frank were in Europe, and, well, Gordon and I have been talking by phone ever since.
I see.
As she realized who Nessa was talking about, Dovey gave her an odd look. This was worse than Nessa had feared.
I didn't mean to fall in love with him. It just happened. And I do love him, Dovey, really and truly. He's asked me to meet him in Kansas City next week.
Why Kansas City?
It's neutral ground for us both. He's away from his home and family and friends, and I'm away from mine. We need to see each other again, to test how we really feel.
You love him?
Nessa nodded.
If he asks me to marry him, and Davy, I pray that he does, I'll leap at the offer.
Good for you, Davy hugged her. Nessa stared at her. This wasn't the reaction she had expected.
You don't mind?
Good grief! Why should I? I'd forgotten Gordon's name, but I remember him now. He's a real sweetheart.
I think so, too,
Nessa whispered.
But when you first realized who I meant, you got the oddest expression on your face.
Davy blushed. I'm afraid I was beginning to believe Sylvia. She thinks you're having an affair. And frankly, I was beginning to have my suspicions, too. Nessa smiled.
Well, now you know. But we've only met once, that day that he came to the shop. And then it was just 3 or 4 hours. That's why we're meeting in Kansas City. We need to know if we feel the same way when we see each other again.
All I want is for you to be happy, Davy told her. Nessa hugged her sister-in-law. Happiness was what she wanted, too. But it seemed to be getting more and more complicated. The last communication from Val Langley had arrived before the 4th of July. It was a perfumed note informing Travis of her arrival date. Today. Nell had been scrubbing and cleaning the house all week. While she might not be able to compete with Val in looks and sophistication, Nell was an excellent housekeeper. If ever there was a time she wanted her homemaking skills to shine, it was now. I wish you'd relax, Travis muttered as he came into the kitchen. He'd spent his morning writing, with frequent stops to refill his coffee mug. You don't need to do anything to impress Val. I'm not doing this for Val. Travis eyed her quizzically, as though he wasn't sure he believed her. I'm doing this for me, Nell said. Val's going to arrive looking like she walked off the pages of Vogue, and I'm going to look and feel like a country bumpkin. I'll have you know I happen to be madly in love with the woman you're calling a bumpkin.
Good. And don't you forget it.
The doorbell chimed, and Nell felt panic rise up in her. It had to be Travis's ex-wife. The twins started to fuss, and grabbing her youngest daughter and son, Nell held their hands, pulling them with her as she followed Travis to the door. As she suspected, the visitor was Valerie Langley. The woman was everything Nell had feared. Petite, slender, and sophisticated. Picture perfect in what was obviously a designer suit, which probably cost more than Nell's entire clothing budget for the century. This woman was every wife's basic nightmare. Travis, Val cried, and threw her arms around his neck. How good it is to see you again! Nell noticed that Travis extracted himself from the hug with a haste that bordered on rudeness. Val smiled warmly at Nell and the children. This must be Nell and those precious twins. Hello. Would you like something cool to drink? That would be delightful. You wouldn't believe how long it took me to get the rental car and find my way here. You guys don't exactly live close to anything civilized, do you? You'll see to my bags, won't you, Travis? She said, following Nell into the kitchen. Travis ignored Val's instructions and headed into the kitchen right behind her. My, Val said to Nell, glancing about. You're certainly the domesticated type. Well, I do bake all our own bread, Nell said. What had made her feel proud only a short while ago left her feeling gauche and old-fashioned now. How quaint. Some women are willing to invest that kind of time and love in their families, Travis said. Ouch, Val said out of the side of her mouth. I think that little barb was intended for me. Nell grinned, pouring Val a glass of tea. I'm hoping we can be friends, Val. That would be nice, Val agreed. But she sounded as though she considered it highly unlikely. She drank her tea, then announced, I believe I'll go freshen up. What time would you like me for dinner?
We eat a whole lot earlier than 8,
Travis informed her sarcastically.
6, if that's convenient, Nell said, glowering at her husband's rudeness.
I'll be here with bells on, Val promised as she left the kitchen.
Travis, what's gotten into you?
Nell asked when she was sure Val was out of earshot.
You were so rude to her.
I didn't like her attitude toward you.
I appreciate your concern, but I can take care of myself.
Her protective feeling towards Travis's first wife came as a surprise. She hadn't expected to like Valerie, but she sensed a vulnerability beneath the polished exterior. She asked in her note if you and I would set aside some time this evening to chat with her, Travis said.
About what?
I'm not really sure. She asked about Grady and Savannah. I can't imagine why she'd come all this way to meet them. Surely it couldn't have anything to do with Richard Weston, not this long after the trial.
Did she ask about Bitter End again?
Yes. She mentioned it in her note, too. She's after something, that's for sure.
I just don't know what.
Annie and Lucas had been married for 2 weeks. They remained polite, almost comically so, especially in the bedroom. Each day they grew more accustomed to sleeping in the same bed. Lucas kissed Annie when he left for work in the morning, and again before they went to sleep at night. Light kisses, more a quick touch of their lips than a real display of affection. And that was all. Annie was happy with this state of affairs. It was early yet, she reasoned, and they had a lot to learn about each other. The girls accepted her without qualms and were excited to have a new mother. Annie lavished them with love and attention, and they thrived right along with Annie, who felt a new confidence, a new serenity, as a result of being needed and loved. What was settling into her new life, Annie had little time to spend with Jane, whose baby was due any day. Annie had volunteered to help the midwife when her friend went into labor, and Lucas had promised to tag along in case Cal needed someone there for him. The call came early Monday morning, soon after Annie had opened the bookstore.
It's time, Cal said excitedly.
I'm on my way, Annie told him, and punched in the second line to ask Lucas to come and pick her up. When he pulled up in front of the bookstore, he seemed even more excited than Cal had sounded on the phone. The drive from town to the Patterson Ranch took 40 minutes. Cal threw open the door to the back porch the minute they arrived.
Smile, Cal, Annie told him after giving him an affectionate hug. A beautiful baby is about to be born.
It's going to be a difficult birth, Cal muttered, looking pale with concern. I'm just sure of it. And Jane refuses to go to the hospital in Brewster. The woman is too damn stubborn for her own good. You don't know what it's going to be like, Annie said, wanting to reassure him.
Relax, will you, Cal?
Who's with Jane now?
The midwife. Jane kicked me out. She said if all I was going to do was argue with her, she wanted me out of the room.
Go to Jane, Lucas told Annie. As soon as Cal's willing to admit his wife knows more about birth and babies than he does, I'll send him in. Despite Cal's dire predictions of a long, difficult birth, Paul Calvin Patterson arrived without a hitch at 9:58 that evening. Cal was with Jane and the midwife at the time. Annie had dozed off against Lucas's shoulder when she awoke to the sound of an infant's wail and a jubilant shout of, "Hot damn!" Soon afterward, Cal tossed open the bedroom door and let out a cry of sheer undiluted joy.
"I got me a son!"
A round of hugs and tears followed. Before she left, Annie went in to see her friend and hold the baby. Gazing down at the newborn, Annie experienced an ache of longing that reached deep inside her. Tears welled in her eyes.
He looks just like Cal, she whispered, and brushed a finger over the fine, soft hair.
It's the big head, Lucas whispered from behind her, causing Annie to smile. Annie's head again rested on Lucas's shoulder on the ride home. After the long, exciting day, they were both exhausted.
I'm thrilled for Cal and Jane,
Lucas said as they prepared for bed.
This is the first time I've been at a birth, Annie told him. I've never experienced anything even close to this kind of feeling before.
Annie finished brushing her teeth, but remained standing in front of the bathroom sink, savoring the good feelings that had come with the birth of Jane and Cal's son.
Annie? Are you coming to bed?
Lucas joined her in the bathroom and stood behind her.
She turned and faced him. Up to this point, all they'd exchanged were chaste, careful kisses. Now Annie's eyes locked with his as she slipped her arms up his chest and linked them around his neck.
Lucas inhaled sharply.
Annie, I'm ready for bed, she murmured, and brought her mouth to his. The raw hunger that exploded between them took her breath away. They stood in the tiny bathroom with their arms wrapped around each other, sharing deep, uncontrolled kisses. Annie. 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 Between each kiss, Lucas whispered her name. Oh, Annie, I... Yes, Lucas. Make love to me.
Afterwards, Annie slept in Lucas's arms all night, as content as she could ever remember being. The first thing Val did once she'd unpacked her suitcase was reach for a pad of paper and write a long, newsy letter to Richard Weston. Val was quite taken with Richard. They'd met when she'd been assigned as his defense attorney. He'd been charged with a number of crimes, smuggling illegal aliens, fraud, and extortion among them. Richard was no innocent. But in Val's opinion, he wasn't as bad as those charges suggested. She liked him. Liked him far more than she should. But then, she'd always enjoyed a man with a dangerous edge. Bad boys like Richard Weston had always tempted her. Richard had written her after he was sentenced. In the beginning, she'd ignored his letters, but his persistence had captured her attention. Almost against her will, after maybe the fifth letter, she started answering him. It had started as a game, a flirtation of sorts. The things he said and wrote to her were enough to make her knees grow weak. She knew better, yet she still couldn't help herself. Her marriage, which had been on the rocks for some time, was ending, and it felt good to be flattered, desired. He had a manner she found compelling, almost irresistible. Naturally, his undying devotion came with a price tag. Richard needed something from her, too, her legal expertise. The simple truth was that she'd fallen for Richard. During the months she'd been working for him, she'd come to look forward to their brief visits. In fact, her motives for traveling to Promise were all linked to helping Richard. He needed his family, and Val had come to Texas to make sure that when the time came, his brother and sister, Grady and Savannah, would stand by him. Richard seemed obsessed with Bitter End, too, although she couldn't quite understand why. He said he couldn't stand the thought of the ghost town being turned into a tourist trap, its historic value ruined. A knock on the door caught Val unaware. She shoved the writing tablet beneath her pillow. "Come in," she called. Travis opened the door and stuck his head inside.
Dinner will be on the table in 15 minutes.
Already?
Val glanced at her watch. I told you earlier that we eat at 6.
I'll be right in, she said, refusing to let his lack of welcome dissuade her.
Fine. He turned to leave.
Travis?
She leaped up and hurried after him.
I have some questions I was hoping you could answer.
About what? He didn't slow his pace, and Val was forced to trot to keep up.
You don't want me here, do you?
She said, pouting ever so slightly. No.
Why not?
He stopped walking and grabbed her by the arm. You're after something.
Don't be ridiculous, Val jerked her arm out of his grasp. She had always resented the way he could see through her.
Then I don't know why you made the trip.
I'm curious about Promise.
Why?
I'd like to meet some of the people who live here.
Such as?
The people you mentioned when you first came out here.
Such as?
The Westons.
Suddenly, Travis knew what Val was up to.
Does your sudden interest in Promise have anything to do with Richard Weston? Be warned, Richard is a user, and if he's had anything to do with your visit, you'd be wise to leave now.
The time with Gordon had been heaven. Nessa mused as they sat in the taxi taking them to the Kansas City airport. They'd spent 3 days together, and for those 3 days, she lived a life of enchantment and perfect happiness, perfect romance. She and Gordon had been inseparable. In their time together, they'd laughed and talked and joked and kissed. If Nessa hadn't already been in love with Gordon, these few days would have had her falling head over heels. Unfortunately, 3 days had flown past far too quickly, and now they had to return to their separate lives. Reluctantly, delaying as long as possible, they'd departed for the airport with only an hour to spare. The taxi pulled up to the departure area, and while Gordon paid the driver and dealt with the luggage, Nessa took care of the tickets. Since they were traveling on two different airlines, and her flight left first, Gordon walked her to the gate. They waited in the departure lounge, holding hands, neither of them inclined to speak.
"I'll call you tonight," Gordon promised, as boarding for her flight was announced.
"Okay." The lump in her throat seemed to grow. The passengers waiting to board the plane formed a long, straggling line. Not until the line had completely vanished did Nessa finally say,
"I should go." Gordon nodded sadly.
She picked up her carry-on, and Gordon accompanied her to the attendant at the gate. Smiling was as impossible as she'd known it would be. She dared not look at him for fear he'd see the tears in her eyes.
"Thank you," she whispered. "I had such a wonderful time. I'll always remember these days with you."
They hugged, and Gordon kissed her.
"I love you," Gordon said, holding her tightly in his arms.
"Oh, Gordon, I love you too."
"I didn't plan to do it now, but I can't let you go. Not like this."
"Marry me, Nessa." She pressed her fingertips to her lips in an effort to forestall the unexpected rush of tears.
"Oh, Gordon."
"Excuse me," the airline clerk said, glancing toward the empty jetway. "Are you on this flight?" Nessa nodded, barely breaking eye contact with Gordon to answer the young man. "You should board right away, ma'am," he said politely.
"I will."
She reached for Gordon's hand and clasped it tightly. The thought of leaving him now was unbearable.
"Marry me, Nessa," Gordon pleaded a second time.
"Hurry up and say yes," the young man urged.
"Yes,"
Nessa said. Gordon and Nessa clung to each other. "I love you," he whispered again.
"I love you too."
"I'll tell Miles tonight."
"Wait," Nessa advised. "Sleep on it."
"I know what I want, and that's to be with you for the rest of my life." And that was exactly what she wanted, too.
Once Annie and Lucas had made love, Annie wondered why they'd waited so long. She soon discovered that Lucas had a vigorous appetite for lovemaking. He seemed almost apologetic for wanting her as often as he did, although she had no objection.
"I never thought it'd be this good," Lucas told her late one night. He paused, then added in a low voice, "Julia was sick for months before she died, and she couldn't. Until you and I got married, I'd assumed that part of my life was over."
Annie pressed the side of her face against his shoulder and wrapped her arm around his middle.
"I, for one, am most appreciative that it isn't."
She felt his smile and knew her words had pleased him. He rubbed her back in long, gentle strokes.
"Lucas, after I'm pregnant, will we continue to make love?"
"Would you mind if we did?"
"No, of course not. I'd like to."
Their lovemaking was wonderful, and Annie would have missed it dreadfully had he decided otherwise. But their time in bed was only a small part of their marriage. The physical intimacy paled next to the emotional intimacy she shared with him. This was all part of the gift she'd been given, part of life's compensation for all she'd endured. Sometimes, it almost felt as if this joy, this contentment, was more than one person could possibly deserve.
"You awake?" Lucas asked a few moments later in a hushed whisper that was more breath than sound.
"Barely." "Thank you," he said in the same low tone.
"For what?"
"For this. For making my girls feel safe and happy." He paused. "For everything." Annie didn't bother to tell him that she was the one who should be giving thanks. The happiness that filled Nessa lasted the entire flight. She felt giddy with love, and so damn happy it was all she could do to sit still.
It was dark by the time the Boeing 737 touched down. Nessa didn't relish the long bus ride she would have to take back to Promise, but nothing could destroy this wonderful feeling inside her. Almost nothing, she revised, as she reached the baggage claim area in the San Antonio terminal where she saw her daughter, Sylvia, glaring at her.
"Welcome home, Mother,"
Sylvia spoke as if Nessa were some disobedient schoolgirl who'd been caught skipping classes.
"Sylvia, what are you doing here?"
Her daughter didn't answer.
"Just where were you?" she demanded instead. "Kansas City." "You were with a man, weren't you?"
"Yes." That seemed to be more than Sylvia could bear. She cast Nessa a horrified look. The drive from the airport to Promise was an uncomfortable one. Nessa said little to Sylvia, beyond telling her who Gordon was, a widower and retired judge from Toronto. Her daughter's attitude practically implied that Nessa deserved to wear a scarlet letter, maybe F for fool, since A for adulteress hardly applied.
"I still don't understand how you knew I was with Gordon," Nessa said as they arrived at her house. "How well do you know this man, Mother?" Sylvia asked. "This Gordon Pauling from Canada?"
The distaste in her voice angered Nessa.
"Well enough to agree to marry him." "Marry him? You're..."
Speechless, Sylvia stared at her.
"Engaged,"
Nessa supplied.
"To a Canadian?"
Nessa nearly laughed out loud. Sylvia made it sound as if she'd agreed to marry a man from another planet.
"Yes, a Canadian." "Did you have him checked out?"
"Gordon?
Checked out? Whatever for?" "He could be after your money, Mother."
Sylvia seemed to think that should be obvious. Nessa was reasonably well off financially, with enough retirement money to live comfortably, but by no means extravagantly.
"He's not after my money." "You don't know that. You're so in love with this person."
"You aren't thinking straight," Miles continued his tirade, until it was all Gordon could do to keep his temper in check. "You know next to nothing about her."
"I know everything that's necessary."
Miles began pacing the library. "I expected much better from you."
"Better? You've never met Nessa.
If you do, you'll see what a wonderful woman she is.
You might have let me know you were leaving for Kansas City."
"I don't need your permission, Miles." His son glared at him.
"Are you saying you'd marry this gold digger no matter what I think?"
Just off the plane, Gordon was tired and emotionally drained. The last thing he wanted was a major argument with his only child.
"Miles, listen. I had her checked out."
"You what?"
"I hired a private detective."
Gordon couldn't believe it. How dare Miles presume he had the right to interfere like this? What he'd done was insulting, intolerable.
"Don't you want to know what he found out?"
Miles asked, as though he'd uncovered enough dirt to take the case to the grand jury.
"Absolutely not."
Gordon was outraged and prayed Nessa would never learn what his son had done. He slammed his hand on the top of his desk.
I think it'd be best if you left now.
Miles's jaw sagged open.
You're kicking me out of the home where I was born and raised?
Gordon didn't reply. Miles grabbed his umbrella and headed out of the library. When he reached the door, he turned back.
Well, I guess it's true what they say. There's no fool like an old fool.
Thank you for those words of infinite wisdom, Gordon muttered. Miles shook his head, then rushed out, making sure the front door slammed in his wake. Sitting down, Gordon drew in a deep breath to slow his pounding heart. He only hoped that Nessa hadn't been subjected to the same kind of inquisition from her daughter. He rapidly dialed her phone number.
Hello? A woman answered, one who sounded almost like Nessa. Who is this?
Gordon Pauling, Gordon said, certain he must be speaking to Sylvia. Is Nessa available?
No. And she won't be for a long time. Sylvia lowered her voice. I want you to know, I found out about the inquiries you made into my mother's financial affairs.
Gordon groaned inwardly and was about to explain that the private detective had been his son's doing and not his, but he wasn't allowed to finish.
You can forget about marrying my mother, Mr. Pauling. Neither my brothers nor I will allow it.
With that, she slammed down the phone, and Gordon was left to listen to the irritating buzz of a disconnected line. Grady Weston walked from the barn toward the main house. He'd put in a long day repairing a windmill that supplied a watering hole for his cattle. Knowing he'd be able to spend the night relaxing with his wife and family made up for all the hard work and the worries that accompanied a rancher's life. He noticed Travis Grant's car parked in the yard. He went and joined the rider on the front porch.
Howdy, Travis.
Grady, Travis stood, and the two men shook hands.
Anything I can do for you?
I don't know if you've heard, but my ex-wife, Val Langley's in town. The name was oddly familiar, but Grady couldn't remember where he'd heard it.
What's that got to do with me?
She defended Richard against charges in New York 3 years ago, Travis said. So that was why the name rang a bell, because of her connection with Richard. Without so much as meeting the woman, Grady instantly distrusted her. He didn't allow himself to like or trust anyone connected with his brother.
What's she doing in Promise?
She's finally admitted to me that she's doing some work on Richard's behalf. But she didn't say exactly what.
I don't mean to pry, but have you heard anything from your brother recently?
Grady nodded.
For the first time in 3 years. He claims he's a changed man and wants our forgiveness.
Do you believe him? Grady snorted.
About as much as I believe pigs fly.
A hint of a smile touched Travis's mouth.
Were you aware that your brother might be eligible for parole in less than 2 years?
You're kidding, right? Grady shook his head in disgust. He appears to be deeply concerned about what's happened to Bitter End, too. Val said he was afraid Promise would use it to attract tourists. Grady scratched his head.
I hate to play dumb here, Travis, but the only person my brother has ever cared about is himself. If he's interested in the ghost town, then it's for his own selfish reasons.
Do you know what those interests might be? Grady shook his head.
I don't have a clue.
Travis frowned. Well, something's going on, and we'd better figure out what it is. Nessa hadn't spoken to Gordon in 2 days. 2 very difficult days. Sylvia had hounded her constantly until she felt she had no choice but to delay the wedding. She fully intended to marry him and only wanted to postpone setting the day, but just until her children had the opportunity to meet him. That wasn't an unreasonable request. It would help if she met Miles, too. What she didn't want to tell Gordon was that he had a lot to make up for in the eyes of her daughter. Sylvie had taken such delight in telling her Gordon had hired a private detective who'd investigated her background, her life, and her finances. Nessa could say nothing in Gordon's defense and decided it would be best if Gordon did the explaining himself. With her pulse raging, Nessa waited until evening and then punched out Gordon's phone number. 3 rings later, a man answered. It wasn't Gordon.
"May I take a message?"
he asked with stiff politeness.
"Please," Nessa said. "My name's Vanessa Boyd."
"Oh." His voice, already cool, dropped to sub-freezing temperatures. "This is Miles Pauling, Gordon's son."
"Hello, Miles," she said, refusing to allow his unfriendliness to deter her. "Your father has mentioned you often."
"I'll bet he has. Has he also mentioned that I'm opposed to this wedding you've supposedly planned?" So Gordon had faced family disapproval as well. That explained why she hadn't heard from him.
"No, he hasn't. But I'm hoping you'll give me a chance, Miles. I happen to love your father very much."
"You love his bank balance more, though, right?"
"I beg your pardon?"
Nessa struggled with her composure. What a cruel and ugly thing to say to her.
"My father's a wealthy man, but then you already know that, don't you, Mrs. Boyd?"
"Yes. Your father is rich in strength of character, intelligence, and grace. The truth is, I wasn't aware of his financial standing, but now that I am, this all makes a lot more sense. You're worried that I'm only interested in him because of his money."
"Isn't that so?"
"You vastly underrate your father, Miles. And her, too. But she didn't say that."
Nessa heard a voice in the background and knew it was Gordon.
"You don't need to tell your father I phoned," she told him. "Goodbye, Miles. And don't worry. I won't trouble either of you again."
She didn't wait for a response, and with tears stinging her eyes, she broke the connection. Annie did a brisk business at Tumbleweed Books that afternoon, and was ready to close for the night when Jane entered the store, carrying Paul in his infant seat. He was sound asleep, and his innocence, his vulnerability, clutched at Annie's heart. She breathed in his baby scent, smiling as Jane put the seat on the counter between them.
"No one told me it'd take a half an hour to get a baby ready for a trip into town," Jane said, slipping the diaper bag off her shoulder and setting it on the floor.
"Don't tell me you're complaining already," Annie teased.
"Oh, I'm not complaining," Jane said.
"I am worn out, though," she said as she sank into the cushions with a sigh. Annie wondered if she'd be as natural a mother as Jane. Then, without warning, the room suddenly felt too hot. Perspiration moistened her brow, and she fell into the chair across from Jane.
"Annie? Jane? Oh, my goodness. What is it? I'm feeling lightheaded all of a sudden. Have you been unusually tired as well?"
Now that she thought about it, Annie realized she had.
"Yes."
Jane asked her several other questions, and Annie wondered if her friend recognized these symptoms.
"Annie," Jane said once Annie was finished speaking, "my guess is you're pregnant."
"Don't be ridiculous. It's much too soon."
But was it? Could she possibly be pregnant?
She and Lucas hadn't practiced birth control, but Annie had assumed that because of her medical history, getting pregnant would take time.
"How can it be too soon?" Jane asked, sounding perfectly reasonable.
"A baby."
That explained the boundless happiness Annie'd experienced of late. This protective barrier that kept problems at bay. The irrepressible feelings that everything was right with the world.
"Does Lucas know?" Jane asked.
Annie shook her head. "How could he when I didn't know myself?"
"You can get a pregnancy kit and find out today," Jane said.
No. If Annie was pregnant, then she was barely so, and her body would soon catch up with the knowledge in her heart. By the end of the month, she'd have missed her first period,
She would make an appointment at the health clinic then. If she wasn't pregnant, she didn't want to destroy the illusion this quickly. The next morning, Cal Patterson put in a call to Lucas about a sick mare. But it took Lucas until late in the afternoon to get back to him. Fortunately, it wasn't an emergency.
How about a cup of coffee? Cal suggested after Lucas had finished with the mare. Sounds damn good about now, Lucas agreed, and headed toward the house with Cal. I guess you're pleased about Annie, Cal said casually.
Lucas found the statement odd.
I'll say one thing. It sure didn't take you too long, Cal joked, elbowing Lucas in the ribs. What the hell are you talking about? Annie's pregnant, isn't she? Cal asked. I overheard Jane talking to her on the phone. When I said something about it, she said I should talk to you.
Annie's pregnant? Lucas stopped in his tracks. Lucas felt as though he'd been sucker-punched. It was all he could do not to reveal his shock. His friend shouldn't be the one giving him the news. His wife should. He was about to become a father. This wasn't the sort of thing a wife usually keeps from her husband, and he couldn't imagine why Annie hadn't told him herself. She must know he'd be pleased. Surely she knew that.
I don't know why you two want to keep it a secret, Cal said, cutting into his frenzied thoughts.
It wasn't until he was driving home, away from the lonesome coyote ranch, that the full reality of what Cal had said hit him. Annie was pregnant. For the third time in his life, he was going to be a father. Actually, it shouldn't come as such a shock, seeing how often they'd made love. In retrospect, Lucas realized this explained a lot. How pale Annie had been lately. Some nights she'd fallen asleep before he got home. Perhaps she was waiting for him to say something. The truth was, he enjoyed gently waking her, having her open her arms to him, warm and sleepy, warm and loving. With that realization came another. Lucas's hands gripped the steering wheel with such intensity, his fingers grew white. He'd really done it now. What he thought was impossible had happened. He'd gone and fallen in love with Annie. Lucas had never intended to love Annie. It wasn't that he couldn't love her, but that he'd purposely chosen not to. With love came the incredible risk of loss. He'd buried one wife, and God help him, he didn't have the strength to do it again. But now, with the realization that he loved her, came the knowledge that if anything happened to Annie, Lucas would be destroyed. Nessa sat through the entire church service Sunday morning and barely heard a word of the sermon. On past occasions, she'd always come away from the service feeling renewed and refreshed. Not this morning. It was all she could do to smile and exchange pleasantries with friends. All she could do to pretend her heart wasn't breaking. Her life, which had been perfectly satisfactory until the day she met Gordon, now felt empty, flat, lonely. And more empty, lonely years stretched ahead. At the end of the service, she left the church and walked toward the parking lot. She thought she heard someone call her name, but she didn't stop. She didn't want to encourage friendly conversation, not today.
Nessa! Davy's call was louder and more insistent this time. Given no option, Nessa stopped and turned. Wait up! Davy pressed her hand over her heart when she reached Nessa. My goodness! I don't know when I've seen anyone leave a church faster. Davy studied Nessa until she grew uncomfortable with the scrutiny. Okay. What's wrong?
Wrong? Why, nothing.
Sure. When was the last time you spoke to Gordon?
Gordon? Oh, we spoke last week sometime.
Dovey's expression told Nessa her sister-in-law wasn't so easily fooled.
How are the wedding plans?
Nessa sometimes forgot what a big mouth her daughter had.
Apparently, Dovey knew everything. I don't think there's going to be any wedding. We have different backgrounds and live in different places, and we each have opinionated children who seem to think that we don't...
Your children are more than opinionated, Dovey cut in. They want to control your lives.
Are you going to allow your family to stand between you and Gordon? To interfere with your happiness?
Nessa knew her daughter meant well, and she was certain Miles's concern was also for his father's well-being. It had taken Nessa some time to appreciate their children's concerns. She realized they were afraid of the changes that would occur in their own lives if she married Gordon, afraid she'd be taken from them to live in another country, afraid she'd love them less.
"Are you going to stand for it?" Dovey asked a second time. "Gordon is a good man.
Are you willing to lose him?"
Nessa had lost so much already she couldn't bear the thought of her life without Gordon.
"You're right. You're so right," Nessa cried. "This is my life. Sylvia didn't seek my approval when she got married. My boys didn't either."
"I don't know why Sylvia feels the way she does, but it's her problem," Dovey insisted.
"Not yours." Nessa felt as if a huge weight had lifted from her heart.
"Dovey, thank you. Thank you so much," Nessa whispered, so grateful she felt close to tears. Her resolve didn't desert her as she drove home. She walked into her house and, without stopping, headed directly for the telephone. If Miles answered, Nessa decided she would demand to talk to Gordon. She wasn't a woman who made demands easily, but she refused to be manipulated anymore. She was so determined and so raring to do battle with his son that when Gordon answered on the third ring, she was caught unaware. "Gordon? Nessa?" Taking a deep breath, she spilled out the secrets of her heart. "I love you. I'm sorry Miles doesn't approve of me. I profoundly regret the way my own children have treated you. But I refuse to allow anyone else to make my decisions for me."
"Oh, Nessa, I thought you never wanted to speak to me again. Do you still want to marry me?"
"Yes." "When?" "Today, tomorrow, next week, whenever you want."
"I want you with me right now."
Nessa closed her eyes at the burst of joy that flowed through her.
"I've been miserable without you," he confessed.
"Me too. I love my children, but this is my life."
"I told Miles the same thing. But when I didn't hear from you, I was sure you'd changed your mind."
They talked for nearly an hour, and when they hung up, Nessa felt wonderful. Her heart was full.
Several days had passed since Lucas had learned that Annie was carrying his child. Still, Annie said nothing. Lucas struggled to deal with emotions that confused and frustrated him.
Damn it! What was he going to do?
He was in love with her, and his confused emotions were tearing him apart. He was so frightened. He couldn't lose Annie, couldn't let her go. Lucas found himself watching Annie, waiting for her to enlighten him with the news. He didn't know what prompted her silence, couldn't begin to guess at her reasons. The longer she delayed, the more confused he became, and with the confusion came a slow-burning resentment. Monday night, following a meeting with the Cattlemen's Association, Lucas got home late. Lucas assumed Annie would be asleep by the time he slipped beneath the covers. As soon as he was in bed, she rolled over and tucked her head against his shoulder.
"Honey, there's something I've been meaning to tell you," she said.
"It seems... I know it's unexpected and all, but... it looks like I'm pregnant."
Now that she'd actually told him, he no longer knew how to react. He opened his mouth to tell her how glad he was, but no words came. Nothing.
"I had an appointment at the health clinic this afternoon," she was saying, "and
It's official. I suspected earlier, but wasn't sure enough to say anything.
Lucas felt as though his jaw had locked, leaving him unable to respond.
Lucas? Did you hear what I said?
His fears were multiple and intensifying every minute.
I heard.
Isn't there anything you want to say?
Jane knew. Cal, too. You might have told me sooner.
But I wasn't sure.
Sure enough to tell Jane, though, and not me.
He eased himself away from her and rolled onto his side. He hadn't intended to push her away, but that was what happened. Grady Weston had learned early in life that if he had a question, going to the source was the best way to get an answer. He was determined to ask Mrs. Big City Attorney herself why she'd come to Promise. It was a couple of days after Travis's visit that Grady had some free time. He headed for Nell and Travis's ranch, 10 miles east of his own spread. Somehow this New Yorker was acting on Richard's behalf. Of that, Grady was convinced. His crafty, manipulative brother was trying to sneak back into their lives. He'd phoned ahead of time, so Travis was waiting for him. The two men exchanged hearty handshakes.
"Is Val around?" Grady asked as they walked across the yard toward the house. "Inside, I told her you were coming."
Val sat in the living room with her long, shapely legs crossed, drinking coffee out of a mug. She glanced up when Travis and Grady came into the room.
"You must be Grady Weston. I understand you have a few questions you wanted to ask me."
"I do. I hear you're doing some work for my brother."
"That's right."
"Is my brother paying you?"
"No," Val admitted with some reluctance. "Actually, I've been working on his case without any compensation."
"Why?"
Grady suspected the reason. Somehow Richard had been able to charm and cajole the sophisticated attorney into believing in his innocence. He'd seen it happen before, had, in fact, fallen for Richard's clever lies himself.
"I believe in Richard, and I'm fairly confident I can handle your brother, Mr. Weston. He loves his family and wanted me to do what I could to build a bridge between him and his brother and sister."
Unable to hold back his amusement, Grady snickered loudly. The only time Richard ever loved his family was when he needed something. "What does he want now?"
"I think I can answer that," Travis said. "This has to do with the parole hearing, doesn't it, Val? You're hoping to inundate the judge with testimonies of what a fine, upstanding citizen Richard Weston is." One glance at the attorney told Grady the truth.
"You're joking, right?"
"It would be of considerable value if you were to write a letter on your brother's behalf," Val said, batting her baby blues in his direction.
"You can forget that."
She heaved a deep sigh.
"Richard told me how jealous you were of him while growing up, how you resented his popularity and good looks. You stole his inheritance, didn't you? For your own selfish reasons. Yet Richard's willing to overlook all that. And in exchange, all he wants is a helping hand."
"I'll help him all right," Grady said from between clenched teeth.
Richard could lie all he wanted. Grady knew the truth. And so did everyone else in Promise.
"Richard wanted you to check out Bitter End, too," Travis said, cutting in.
"Yes, he's worried about what's happened to the ghost town."
"I'll just bet he is."
"You underestimate your brother, Mr. Weston," Val said. "Richard wants to protect it."
"Does he now?"
It was difficult to keep a straight face, but Grady managed. This poor woman had lost all sense of the truth. Richard had completely taken her in. The word bamboozled came to mind.
"I don't think this conversation is going anywhere," Val murmured, setting down her coffee cup. Without another word, she strode out of the house. After she'd left, Travis walked Grady back outside.
"What do you think?" he asked. "He's using her,"
Travis nodded.
"That much is obvious. Do you understand this business about Bitter End?"
"No," Travis admitted.
Nell and I paid a visit there recently. We both feel there's something we're missing.
I can tell you right now, if Richard's interested in the ghost town, then there's a reason.
But what could it be?
I wonder if we'll ever know, Grady said with a shrug. Do you think he might have left something of value there? I know he didn't have any money.
Then what?
Hell if I know. Grady studied Travis. You're the one who unraveled the mystery of Bitter End. Maybe you can figure this one out, too.
Travis chuckled. I'll give it some thought. I've already got a couple of ideas. You know, Travis said, shaking his head, I find it hard to believe I was ever married to Val. I almost feel sorry for her now.
Grady did, too, knowing that Val Langley was in line for a rude awakening.
Anyone who'd ever befriended Richard ended up regretting it, sooner or later. After their Bitter End date, Jeannie and Adam had been out twice bowling and on a picnic, but they were still uneasy with each other. Adam often waited several days between dates to call her again, as if he feared she'd change her mind about him. They were taking this slow and easy, and in truth, Jeannie didn't mind. They were on their fourth date, having lunch at Promise's Mexican restaurant, the Chili Pepper, when the door to the restaurant opened and Travis Grant entered. Grady Weston and a woman neither Adam nor Jeannie recognized followed close behind. Travis had, at Grady's request, been doing a lot of thinking about what Richard's interest in Bitter End could possibly be. After a lot of brainstorming and a bit of research, he'd come up with an idea that seemed promising and proposed it to Val and Grady. Val had scoffed at the idea, but Grady was intrigued. Now Travis needed Jeannie's help to confirm his theory.
You looking for me? Adam asked in crisp, businesslike tones. Trouble? Actually, we need to talk to both of you, Travis said, sliding into the booth next to Adam. Adam, Jeannie, this is Val Langley. She's a lawyer doing some research on behalf of Richard Weston, Grady's brother.
Val claimed the seat beside Jeannie, and Grady pulled up a chair.
You have a question? Adam asked.
More a difference of opinion, Val said, folding her arms as though to put distance between herself and the others.
Tell me the story of One-Eyed Jack again, would you? Travis asked Jeannie.
I've already told you everything I know, Jeannie said. He lost his eye in the Civil War and later became the leader of a band of renegade soldiers who rode across Texas, wreaking havoc wherever they went.
But you said he robbed a Union paymaster, right?
As I recall, left the poor guy for dead.
Whatever happened to the gold coins?
I don't have any idea.
I do, Travis said. I have a very good idea what happened to it.
Annie left with Heather and Holly for the bookstore the next morning without speaking to Lucas. Lucas had tried to pretend that everything was normal and had gone into the office. But as soon as he arrived, he realized it was useless to try to work. He sat down, pulled down the shades, and closed the door. He sat in the semi-dark room trying to sort through his thoughts. When Annie told him about the baby the night before, Lucas had reacted with anger. He'd felt confused and betrayed. It seemed everyone in town knew his wife was pregnant before he did. Well, maybe that was an exaggeration, but he felt he should have been the first to know. She'd hurt him, but now he'd gone and hurt her, too. Lucas was miserable, and knew he would be until he'd settled this with Annie. Abruptly, he got up and left his office. A short time later, he arrived at Tumbleweed Books and charged inside. The bell above the door jangled as he entered. His wife glanced up and froze when she saw him. She recovered quickly, turning her gaze away.
Where are the kids?
The girls went out for ice cream with Caroline and her kids.
He came two steps farther into the store.
Can we talk?
She nodded, but still refused to look at him. I'm sorry, Annie.
For what?
For everything. for the way I acted when you told me about the baby? I was the one who wanted a child. It was my stipulation for the marriage, not yours. There's no reason for you to be happy that I'm pregnant. But I am. I'm thrilled. I know our agreement wasn't about loving each other, but I do hope you'll love our child. It never occurred to Lucas that he wouldn't. I already do. The same way I love his or her mother. Annie went still, as if she wasn't sure she'd heard him correctly. Are you saying you love me? That's exactly what I'm saying. That's what I came here to tell you. The distance between them dissolved as she raced toward him. Lucas met her more than halfway, hauling her into his embrace, finding her mouth with his own, and kissing her with an intensity that left her in no doubt of his feelings. "We need to call Pastor McMillan," he whispered, holding Annie against him. "But why?" "I want us to get married."
"We are married."
Lucas heard the smile in her voice and felt like laughing himself.
"I want us to repeat our vows."
"I love you, Annie, heart and soul." "Oh, Lucas, I love you too." He continued to hold her, his arms wrapped about her waist.
"For the life of me, I can't imagine why you should.
But I'm grateful, so very grateful that you do." Travis grinned at the people assembled before him, nachos and drinks forgotten. Ever since Val had sent word of her impending visit, something had been niggling in the back of his mind, especially when he discovered that Richard was responsible for Val's sudden interest in Promise and the ghost town. Nell shared his suspicions, but it wasn't until after they'd run into Jeannie and Adam at Bitter End that everything had started to come together.
"You know something about that gold?" the sheriff asked, studying him from the other end of the booth. "As soon as I heard about Richard's interest in the town, I suspected it had to be for one of two reasons.
He left something of value in Promise, or he found something he doesn't want anyone to know about. Otherwise, he wouldn't give a tinker's damn about Bitter End."
Everyone nodded in agreement, except Val, who gave an unladylike snicker.
"I sincerely doubt that." "So, you think Richard found the gold?" Jeannie asked. "What gave you that idea?"
"When you mentioned the story about One-Eyed Jack, I decided to do a bit of research. I believe Richard found One-Eyed Jack's stash when he was rooting around the town. And that's what he wants now. It's why he sent you to snoop around, Val."
"Oh, she sputtered. "This is so ridiculous."
"Is anyone interested in hearing what I found out?"
"I am," Jeannie told him.
"Me too," Adam said. "Okay," Travis began. "Do you know if anyone ever learned the name of the man who hanged the preacher's son?"
"I don't follow you," Jeannie said.
"All this time, we've assumed a few men in town had too much to drink and got carried away." Travis looked around the table and saw Adam and Jeannie nod their heads in agreement.
"Are you suggesting it wasn't the locals?" Jeannie asked. Travis shrugged.
"Oh, I think a few men from Promise were involved. When I researched Jeannie's story about One-Eyed Jack and that stolen union payroll, I discovered that the date of the robbery was only a week or so before the hanging." He paused, glancing around. "My guess is that One-Eyed Jack and his band of renegades were on the run and stopped in the town."
"I already told you, you can't prove that," Val cried.
"You're right, but it all adds up," he grinned. "Perhaps it's my creative imagination, Val. I'm a writer, so I tend to look for endings. I want to see how the story comes out."
"If it was One-Eyed Jack's men, you think they had the gold with them?" Adam asked.
"I'm guessing they did."
Jeannie leaned in excitedly.
And now, you're suggesting Richard Weston found the gold and hid it somewhere in town.
Well, it makes sense, doesn't it? Travis said. Grady nodded. And I know for a fact that Richard came to promise with nothing.
This is beyond belief, Val shouted.
But where could he have hidden it? Travis continued, as if she hadn't spoken.
There are no gold coins in Bitter End, Val said, and if there were, don't you think Richard would have mentioned them to me?
Why should he? Travis asked.
Well, because
I've befriended him. For the last couple of years, I've put countless hours into his defense without a penny's compensation. Trust me, if he had access to that kind of money, he would have told me about it.
Grady's eyes went cold. It's time you woke up and realized the truth about Richard. You don't know what he's like.
You're the one who doesn't know Richard, Val hissed at Grady.
He shook his head sadly. I'm afraid you're about to learn a painful lesson.
Fine, Val said defiantly. If you actually believe such a preposterous idea, then I suggest we all go out to Bitter End and look for this gold ourselves.
Travis glanced around the table and watched as everyone nodded in turn. While Adam paid the bill, Grady, Travis, and Val headed outside and got into Grady's truck. Adam and Jeannie followed them in the patrol car. Once parked on the hill above Bitter End, they all made the arduous trek down the steep grade that led into the old town. They stopped at the outskirts, unsure where to start the search.
Well, Val challenged, her hands on her hips. Show me the gold.
The hotel, Grady said, pointing at it. That's where Jane and Cal found Richard. The stairway collapsed on him, and he'd been trapped for nearly 3 days. He risked his life to climb those rickety old stairs. At the time, I wondered what could have possessed him to take such a foolish chance. He had to know just by looking at them how dangerous they were. A small party gathered in front of the hotel and stared at the dilapidated, half-fallen building.
Even if the gold's hidden somewhere on the second floor, that place isn't safe, Jeannie remarked. Besides, there's no way of reaching it now.
Sure there is, Adam glanced about. Get me a rope, and I'll give you a short demonstration of my army training. I've got a rope in my truck, Grady volunteered, and took off at a trot up the path to the limestone bluff where the vehicles were parked.
Grady returned 20 minutes later, sweating from the exertion of his climb, the rope draped over one shoulder. He handed it to Adam, and they all stepped back and watched as the sheriff expertly swung the rope to the hotel's second-story balcony and anchored it on the railing. He tested it carefully, then decided it would support his weight. Adam hadn't exaggerated his climbing skills, and Travis watched in amazement as the younger man hauled himself up onto the second floor.
"Be careful," Jeannie called, once Adam was safely planted on the balcony.
Don't take any unnecessary chances, Travis shouted. Just find something, Grady added.
Val glared at them all and shook her head. You're out of your minds, every last one of you. Adam disappeared into the hotel, and a few minutes later, Travis heard the sound of wood splintering. Alarm filled him. If anything happened to the sheriff, he'd feel personally responsible.
Adam?
Jeannie screamed, moving forward.
It's okay,
the sheriff's voice was steady. It couldn't have been any longer than 15 minutes, but it felt like hours before a triumphant Adam appeared, holding up a leather pouch.
I found it! He'd hidden it just the way Travis suspected. It was tucked away in a cupboard. I might never have stumbled on it if the weight of it hadn't broken through the rotting wood. What is it? Grady called up to him.
Adam laughed.
Gold! Pure gold!
Grady stared back as if this was impossible to believe. Travis's hunch had been right. The date of the robbery and the date of the wrongful death in Bitter End was the link. How and when the renegades had hidden the gold in Bitter End, and why they never retrieved it, would probably always be a secret.
Travis figured he might never know exactly how Richard had gotten his hands on it either. Once Richard had located it, he must have secured it in the hotel, knowing few would risk investigating the second floor. But his plan had backfired when the stairwell collapsed on him. Trapped as he was now in a prison cell, Weston must have been frantic that someone would uncover his find. All his supposed concern about people's safety and not commercializing the ghost town had been a futile effort to keep anyone else from finding the gold.
"I don't believe it," Val murmured repeatedly. "I just don't believe it."
"Believe it, Miss Langley," Grady advised. "Now you know the truth about Richard. He planned on dumping you as soon as you got him out of prison. Join the club. We've all been used by Richard. You weren't the first, and you surely won't be the last."
"Richard's gonna pay for this," Val hissed. "I'm going to make sure he does."
She didn't intend to waste a minute either. She was going to set the wheels of vengeance turning as fast as she could. Richard Weston was going to pay, by heaven. He would rue the day he'd used and abused Valerie Langley.
Annie gently rocked her sleepy child, cradling her son in her arms and humming softly to him. She'd lived in Promise nearly 2 years now, and the town was everything Jane had said. Everything and more. She'd left California looking for a new life, and she'd found it. New work, a new home, and most important, a husband and family. The bookstore was doing well financially, although Annie was working only part-time these days. Annie loved her time at home with her new baby.
"Is he asleep?" Lucas asked,
tiptoeing into the baby's room. Annie smiled lovingly at her husband and nodded. Gently she brushed the dark curls from little Luke's brow, then stood and placed him in his crib. Lucas joined her and tucked the blanket about his sleeping son's shoulders. As noiselessly as possible, they moved out of the room and closed the door.
"I just got an emergency call," Lucas told her regretfully.
"Go," she told him, wondering at his hesitation.
"But I was looking forward to spending a Saturday afternoon with my wife."
Annie never tired of hearing him refer to her as his wife. It was a word she loved, and a role she loved. Just as wonderful as the other one she'd accepted when she agreed to marry Lucas Porter, being a mother.
"I'm not going anywhere," Annie told him, walking him to the front door. He kissed her.
"I'll call you as soon as I can. I'll be waiting."
"Don't forget to pick up Heather and Holly at 2 from the movie theater."
"As if she would."
"I won't forget," she giggled.
"Now go, scoot. Be gone with you."
"I really do love you, Annie."
"I know."
And she did.
Nessa Pauling sat in her kitchen with brochures from a number of different cruise lines spread across the table. She just couldn't decide. The back door opened and Gordon walked into the room, setting his golf clubs aside.
"The Panama Canal?" Gordon whispered enticingly from behind her. Leaning forward, he kissed her cheek.
"Frank and I talked it over, and since you women can't seem to make up your minds, we're doing it for you."
"But there's no shopping in Panama," Nessa argued.
"You and Dovey have a dozen or more Caribbean islands where you can spend your money, and every store on every one of them takes Visa and American Express."
Gordon opened the refrigerator and brought out a pitcher of iced tea.
"I married you for your money, you know," she teased. Gordon laughed.
"That's all right, because I married you for yours."
"Sylvia believes it to this day."
Actually, Gordon and Sylvia had called a truce soon after the wedding, just as Nessa had with Miles. Gordon's son had given their marriage 3 months. Nessa wanted to laugh every time she thought about it. They'd been married for well over a year now, and the honeymoon didn't show any signs of ending.
"The kids are just worried we're going to squander their inheritance," Gordon said, pulling out a chair and sitting down next to her.
"We are, aren't we? Every last penny of it."
"It might take 2 or 3 lifetimes.
but I'm willing if you are.
It went without saying that she was. The diamond on Jeannie French's left hand sparkled in the light of her first-grade classroom. Adam stood in front of the children, as he did every year, discussing safety and talking about a sheriff's work, ending his talk with a demonstration involving his handcuffs. It was this part her six-year-olds always enjoyed the most. After class, Adam lingered and helped her clean up for the day.
"I'd like a pair of those handcuffs myself," Jeannie told him once the classroom had emptied.
"Any particular reason?"
"I have a few ideas, Sheriff Jordan."
"Ms. French, you shock me."
"Do I now?"
"What exactly would you do if I was foolish enough to give you my handcuffs?"
He dangled them in front of her. Jeannie stood next to her desk, head tilted, and planted her hands on her waist.
"You mean you don't know?"
He waggled his eyebrows.
"I can guess."
"Guess again, Adam Jordan." This was the moment she'd been waiting for.
"I want us to set a date for our wedding. We can work on our relationship until kingdom come. If you aren't ready to marry me now, you never will be."
Adam looked stunned. "If it was up to me, we would have been married a year ago."
"Then why aren't we?"
"Well, because you never said..."
"You never asked. Am I always going to have to be the one to do the asking?"
Jeannie demanded, fighting back a pout.
"I love you, and I want us to be married."
"I want us to be married, too."
"Well, you should have said something sooner."
"Are you willing to set the date or not?"
"Yes," Jeannie said without hesitation.
"Good." They glared at each other. Then Jeannie asked,
"Why are you standing over there when I'm standing over here?"
Adam shook his head. "Hell if I know. Did we or did we not just agree to set our wedding date?"
"We agreed."
Adam pulled her into his arms, joining his hands at the small of her back.
"That's what I thought." "What are you doing next weekend?"
Jeannie laughed, crazy in love with the best-looking sheriff she'd ever known. Grady had been expecting his sister to show up all afternoon, and he wasn't disappointed. Savannah sought him out in his office.
"You heard?" he asked.
She nodded. "There was a letter from Richard in today's mail. The parole boards denied his request, and he blames Val."
"It isn't only Val he blames."
"Why you?"
"I refuse to write a letter to the parole board on his behalf."
"Neither would I," Savannah admitted. She sighed.
"I wish I knew what went wrong with Richard. I've asked myself that 1,000 times over the years, and I've never found an answer that made sense."
Grady had wondered, too.
"How's Val?" he asked. "Have you heard from her recently?"
"Travis and Nell do frequently. Once she'd learned the truth about Richard, Val was hell on wheels, doing everything possible to make sure he served his full sentence. She'd been helpful to the people of Promise, too. Working with another attorney, she helped with the return of the gold coins to the federal government. But her assistance hasn't stopped there. Because of her efforts, money had recently been raised to build a small hospital in Promise."
A new hospital. Grady wondered if he'd recognize the town in a few more years. Then again, he knew he would. Changes would come. The town was destined to grow. But the heart of Promise, the strength and faith that had led the original settlers to leave Bitter End and start over in a new place, that heart would never change.
Thank you for choosing a DH Audio production.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.